This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. It's time for Place to Be Nation's Year in Pop. Each episode, we go back in time to a year in the past and take a trip down memory lane and see what was going on in the worlds of news, sports, and pop culture with your hosts, Andy Atherton and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the Year in Pop. That's right. We start of a new decade, milestone here on Year in Pop, although it's like episode like 8, 9, whatever. But, you know, we're into the 80s, the decade of excess, so to speak. New presidents coming, a new world, new teams in sports, different music is coming. And to break it down, we have the crew here tonight, starting with my co-host. He is the co-host also on the Place to Be podcast over on the wrestling feed. He is a gem on Jenny and the Gems. You can hear him over on the Jenny position on the Journey Through Infinity and many other shows. Mr. Scott Criscolo. Scott, how are you tonight?
I'm well, Mr. Atherton. Good evening to you, sir. Hello, Place to Be Nation on the pop feed. And yeah, talk about pop music. Talk about pop music, which is what we'll be doing, because I think that song came out in 80. Might have been late 79, but it brings in a whole new world, as you said. That song won't come out for a while, but yeah, it's going to be amazing when we get into like music and that kind of stuff. TV will still have a little holdover from the 70s, but when we get to our next couple of episodes, the TV really changes a lot. But I think of all the and we'll talk about it obviously tonight. I think of all the categories, music I think is where things change most. But why don't we bring in the rest of our other two fine gentlemen? Sure. He is my co-host on the NWA Power Recap, two episodes in. Thank you for your support. We got a fresh one coming up this weekend, and he's a contributor to the reaction shows, and which is means he's an extension of Place to Be Nation's main event as well. He is the Doctor, Dr. G, George Polino. And we talked about before the start of the show that there is a change in things. In everything, sports and music and such. But guess what? It's still another year that we'll talk Billy Joel. So Andy could go take a seat.
I love Billy Joel. It's just like, fucking episode.
You know what? I thought that the best of your introduction is you're a gem. That's so
I am
cute.
A gem. It is. I'm a ruby.
God, makes me want to puke.
I'm a ruby. We don't know what Matsuza is yet, but
I don't know
what the June gem is. I have no idea. But anyway, good to have you, Doctor. Andy, fill out the cast here.
Well, this man needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He is over on the Extreme Three-Way Dance on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Also a frequent third man booth on the Place to Be podcast. He's featured here on the pop feed very often. Mr. John Arsenio D'Amato. Johnny, how are you tonight?
Thanks, boys. Great to be on the old cast with the youngsters here. Been fumbling with this Rubik's Cube thing all day, and I've still only been able to get a one color side. That's it.
that's what that sound was coming from Long Island today. This fucking all these, thing.
All these years later, I can only get one side. Yeah.
and that's with peeling the stickers off, right? And putting.
Who would even bother, right? I think I did, but anyway.
I used to have somebody I worked with that guy was like kind of an idiot savant where he could do it blindfolded.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the guy lived on Red Bull and Ritalin, but you know.
Unfortunately, this crew was only half of idiot savants, the first half. So.
Great. All right, so guys, excited. we tackled most of the 70s. I mean, we did start in 72. Maybe we'll go back and cap it off later on down the line. But you know what? Here we are. We're in the 80s, a decade we all grew up, had formative years. You know, Johnny, you were a teen, right, at this time, about teenager, so to speak.
Yes, definitely. Yes, definitely.
And we were, you know, we were, what were we, like, almost like fourth grade, I think, like fifth grade guys, right, around here? A little younger than that, probably.
Oh, God. Well, let's see, 1980, I turned seven. All right. The doctor
so
and I,
so like
I guess that
first,
would be
second
like
grade.
Second grade.
Yeah, yeah. So I was third grade. So, yeah, this is like, for me, you know, because, you know, when compiling the notes and the research for the shows, this is when all the stuff now is starting to be clearer. You know, it's like, oh, my yeah. God, I remember yeah. this. I remember that. I remember this distinctly. So, definitely. You know, our recollections are getting better, so to speak. So we're going to start off quickly. You know, we like to just throw some stats out there, kind of compare to 1982, our current year, 2020. Geez, 40 years ago. You know, cost of a new house was $68,700. That was up quite a bit from 79, almost a little over 10 grand. But the average income only went up 2 grand to 19,500. Your average rent went up $200 to $300 a month. A gallon of gas was $1.19. That was about a 33-cent rise. The inflation rate, 13.58%. And that's up from 11.2. A pound of ground beef was $1.39. A Pontiac Firebird will run you just under 6 grand at $5,992. A Magnavox VHS recorder, a VCR, right? $700.
That's crazy.
And a VHS home movie camera, $1,600.
Those never really got cheap, though, the cameras. Like, obviously, VHS, you know, VCRs would go from $700 to $7 eventually. But movie cameras never got cheap. I mean, $1,600 a lot, but they never, I mean, even in the cheaper years, they never got below, like, $500 or $600.
I actually still have mine, expensive. Too. I got to see if that's
really?
Worth it. Yeah, I do. It was, well, I think it might have been my aunt's, but she gave it to me. I remember that heavy thing, like, on my shoulder. Like, I remember, like, filming, like, family events and just getting, like, sore-ass shoulder and sitting there trying to edit that stuff back in the day with two VCRs. Kind of, you
know. Wow. Yeah. Old school.
Yeah, it's fun, though. That's how I learned how to edit, though, was, you know, now I'm, yeah. Okay, anyway, so... All right, so what was going on in pop culture? A lot of cool stuff, actually, that we got to play with. You know, 2XL Robot. Now, there was this thing called the Big Track. And when I saw the picture of it, it looked like kind of like a big, like, APC, like an armored personnel carrier, but it had, like, a remote control on it. And it was, like, one of the coolest toys I remember. Chips was a hot show at the time. There was a moped you could buy.
I had the Chips moped.
Yeah?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I love that thing.
Those are fun. Color and Curl Candy, which was for the girls. Cosmic Combat, Electronic Game. Incredible Hulk was still pretty popular. Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head. Play-Doh. Gee, did your daughter play with Play-Doh growing up?
Yep, she did.
See, I must have played with it, but somewhere along the line, the smell of Play-Doh just gets to me now. It's like I actually banned it when my kids were little because for some reason the smell... would just get to me, and I'm like, no, get this shit out of my house. I don't know what happened.
That smell was incredible. It was like a drug, man.
It was... okay, maybe I had a bender one night.
Scott ate it, but that's okay.
There was bubblegum-flavored Play-Doh? I didn't know that.
So, other stuff, we had Simon Says, a ventriloquist dummy. Snoopy train set, Star Wars figures, which we've talked about a lot on shows lately. We all had those. Log House, Playful Puppies, Weebles. Weebles wobble. They don't fall down.
But they don't fall down.
And as Johnny referenced, the Rubik's Cube debuted. It debuted internationally during the Toy Fair in London. Erno Rubik in the 70s, he created it. And it was first patented as the Magic Cube in Hungary in 1975. It was a colorful puzzle that was soon picked up by Ideal Toys and developed for the global market. After its introduction, it became a craze. Competitions for who could solve the puzzle the fastest emerged, and it's still pretty popular today. You can find them. You can find mini ones. You can find big ones. There was actually a cartoon, I think it was called Ruby the Magic Cube or something like that, back in the 80s. Now, anybody here actually solve Rubik's Cube that they can remember?
No.
Not even. No way.
I think I came close once, like on one of those little keychain size ones, because it was a lot of many cubes to do. Don't you hate though when you had like a good time, like you were getting through it, and then somebody would come and just fuck it all up on you and just mess it all up?
My brother actually undid his with a screwdriver. Like, there's the two ways to cheat. You could take the stickers off, but who the hell wants to do that? Uh-huh. My brother actually jimmied the thing loose with a screwdriver and positioned them all properly and made them easier to. I don't know why he bothered. Honestly, if you're not going to do it legitimately, why waste the money? In my opinion, that's what I always thought. Mm-hmm. I never bought one because I knew I'd never do it, so I didn't even bother. Mm-hmm. I used to try my brother's, but it was just my opinion. I just felt I knew I was never going to do it, so I never owned one. The waste. I just never bothered. I'd rather buy more Star Wars guys than a fucking Rubik's Cube, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and that actually led to, like, then they had other kind of puzzle cube things coming out. Like, remember there was one like a chain link? It was like a long, rectangle-y kind of thing. So, yeah, those kind of puzzles are still fairly popular today when you go to the store. Also, CNN Cable Network News began broadcasting June 1st of that year. It's an American-based network headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, founded by Ted Turner. It was the first 24-hour news network available to cable subscribers in the United States and Canada, and since became worldwide. It gained many influence and was known for its live coverage, often being the first to broadcast during big news events. Isn't that weird to imagine not having 24-hour networks dedicated to this, that, and the other thing? And in 1980, along came a cable news network. Did your parents watch that stuff back then? Or was that like still like wasn't eking its way into the homes just yet?
Occasional, not. It was still. There was the local news was enough. But like you said, we couldn't fathom it. This is gonna. They don't really think it's gonna fly, but now we just take it for granted. But at the time, yeah, it's like you know, the news a half hour, an hour. That, you know, that's enough at the time. But
and they used to replay it too, so like you got the same news. Like I guess they would do newscasts at certain times, kind of like how Channel 12 does here locally.
Yeah.
So you like, so if you watched it at 8 a.m., the 8:30 a.m. was the same news. I mean, then I think they expanded it a little bit more, but my parents used to watch it. I mean, I kind of remember it a little bit. I remember it more in the mid-80s than I did when it first came out.
Yeah, and nowadays it depends on what your political party affiliation is, on what cable news network you choose to partake in.
In the grand scheme of things, is actually pretty sad. Yeah. But, mm-hmm. And nobody's really watching them. Now with streaming and social media, you know, and Twitter and stuff, nobody even sits and watches. Even 24-hour news networks are dated now. My parents, my family, pretty much like Johnny's. I think my dad was like, I like Channel 8, which is the ABC affiliate here in the New Haven area, and that was it. Or, you know, or Channel 30, whatever. We didn't. My dad was perfectly happy with. Perfectly happy with local news. He didn't trust national people.
Oh yeah,
so he was happy with the newscasters and sportscasters that he met and trusted locally. So, I think it took a while for cable national news to really, you know, reach the con. I think it was when this generation got older that 24-hour news picked up in the mid. I agree with G in the mid 80s. A lot of our parents and our grandparents, they were perfectly happy watching it. You know, 6 and 11.
Yeah, creatures of habit. Took a lot for them to change. I mean, we had, it changed over the years which broadcast, but I remember as a kid, we always watched CBS Channel 2. We had Warner Wolf of Sports, Mr. G, and my dad had a thing for Michelle Marsh, so that's why we always had
CBS. God rest your soul.
Yes. We used to date Dave Jennings, former punter of the Giants.
My dad used to watch, when we watched New York Sport, and I know, G, you watched it too, Channel 11, Jerry Girard with his bad wig doing the sports, and Channel 9, who was Channel 9? Well, no, Russ Salzburg was later in the decade, but
the sweater.
And then you had like Chuck Scarborough and Steve Bosch. Steve Bosch is the one that announced, we talked about it in 79. Steve Bosch was the one who announced that I saw about Thurman's death. Mm-hmm. Here in New York and in the tri-state area, we trusted our own. You know, we didn't like those weird Southern 24-hour-y people. We trusted channels, you know, for you guys, New York, 2, 4,
7,
7, and 11 and 9. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was channels 3, 8, and 30. Mm-hmm. We had our local people we liked. We saw them out in the public. We trusted them. This 24-hour weird thing was not a – I think our generation, us, the kids of the 70s into the 80s are the ones that jumped on the 24-hour bandwagon. But, mm-hmm. Hey, it was on my birthday. That's kind of cool. I didn't know that.
I did like, Scott, the CNN had the half-hour of sports. They even competed with the Sports Center, and that was real good, and that was real popular at the time.
Yes.
They had a good run. I don't know exactly when they got away from it, but for the longest time. And those guys were real popular. It was Charles and Fred Hickman.
Fred Hickman, yeah.
That was a good
– Fred Hickman, nice guy.
It was a good half hour.
It was. No, I agree.
Definitely solid that competed with the Sports Center. Mm-hmm. That was a good part about seeing.
And, of course, in our area we had – Yeah, and of course, in our area, we had Sunday nights. We had George Michael's Sports Machine, still a half-hour show.
That was the coolest
and then, yes, it was. And then, of course, we also had another half-hour show. God rest his soul. Another New York icon, Bill Mazur, used to have an awesome sports show too.
Sports.
Us New Yorkers, New Haveners, Northeasterners. We had our own little cabal of personalities we trusted, mm-hmm. And so yeah, I think the CNN thing. Picked up for our generation by like 84, 85. I think that's when the 24-hour news really picked up, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Also coming out, debuting in 1980, 3M began sales of its latest product, Post-it Notes, invented by Arthur Fry and Spencer Silver. They're officially introduced in the U.S. During April. It was an innovative product featuring a square yellow notepad that had lightweight sticky adhesive strip on the back of each note, making it removable. It's kind of remarkable that, they've only been around since then, too, because who doesn't use Post-it notes? It's kind of silly that we're talking about stationery, but it really kind of revolutionized, communicating in your home and in your office.
Use them all day long.
Yeah. what's when you want to leave a note on somebody's desk, what's the first thing you look for? A Post-it note. Because you could put it, on their monitor so they see the note so they can't say, I didn't see that note. Where'd you leave it? Same thing with my parents, too. They used to leave me Post-it notes all the time.
All right. Guys that wanted to, flirt with their secretaries at work, they would draw pictures of their schmants and put a Post-it note.
Doing a flip book.
That was the precursor. Well,
they'd have camera phones back then, so,
Drawing a schmants was a precursor of a dick pic.
So is that what Anthony Weiner did before he had cell phone?
Except he used one of those little tiny Post-its that, you would little tiny ones you'd write like a number on.
I think when we do our best of show, it's going to be all D'Amato-isms.
Oh, my God. Right. Secretary's getting their spies.
Also that year, there was a mini gold rush in the Australian outback. In Mexico, first ever natural birth in captivity of a giant panda. That's pretty remarkable. I know pandas are very popular out there, especially my significant other is a big fan of pandas, and it's a requirement to at least acquire two or three every year when I go to the amusement park. So, also that year, Pac-Man was released in the arcade. You guys big Pac-Man players back in the day, today, yesterday, tomorrow?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite variation? Is it the original, or is it Miss Pac-Man, or some of the more rarer? There was Pac-Man Jr. There was also a Pac-Man pinball, I think.
I guess I probably played Miss Pac-Man more. The bar that my dad owned for a little while, he had Miss Pac-Man in there, so we were always playing that. So I'd say Miss Pac-Man was mine.
I think where Miss Pac-Man has the better, more appeal for me because the maze has changed. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And like Pac-Man, they stayed the same. And you also had the fruits and they had the little story every few levels. I remember my Aunt Leela, my cousin Johnny, who's 3 years older than me, she rented a Miss Pac-Man game for his birthday. I forgot what year it was, but that was like the coolest thing. I had like a Miss Pac-Man machine in my aunt and uncle's house for a weekend. How cool is that? Johnny, you at the arcades putting your quarters up saying, hey, how you doing?
Not too much. Not too much. Money was tight.
He was too busy buying Post-its.
Yeah, money was tight. The quarters were tight at that time.
I mean, that wasn't my number one game that I played in the arcade. I usually played Galaga or Defender. That was one of my favorites, too. Burger Time. I mean, we'll get to that when those all get invented, but I mean, Pac-Man was epic.
Yeah. You know,
in its own special way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Also, we had some notable deaths in that year. We had the great Jimmy Durante, who was one of my dad's personal favorites. I really don't know. I've seen Jimmy Durante, but I really remember him mostly from his small part in a very long movie, which was It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Yep.
I think I did that right.
He also narrated Frosty the Snowman.
Yes,
too.
That's right. Frosty the Snowman. The Dames. The cha-cha-cha. Yep. A couple of deaths we'll talk about a little later in the music section.
Sorry, Andy, to interrupt. Don't you remember what he did in Mad Mad World, Jimmy Durante?
Yeah, he was the one that he got the whole thing going.
He's the one that died.
Yeah, he died.
No, but
the beginning.
After he died, what did he do? He kicked the bucket, right? Yeah.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie.
Yeah, that was very symbolic. Right after he croaked, he like kicked the bucket down the hill. You know, ha ha, kicked the bucket.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was funny.
That was hot humor back then. But
I gotta tell
and
you,
then ironic. And this year he did actually kick the bucket. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it came out way before any of our years that we're talking about. But it is, if you're interested in seeing a funny movie with a lot of classic actors, that's a movie to seek out. It's a little long.
Absolutely.
A little long, but you know, you got Jonathan Winters, you got
Winters was tremendous.
Rooney,
yes.
You got Buddy Hackett, you know, Phil Silvers. I mean, it's just go on and on and on the cast. So also we'll talk about a little bit later on in the music section, but Bon Scott of AC/DC passed away. John Paul Sartre, the philosopher, I believe. Just double check my notes. Yeah, he was a philosopher. I only really know him by Chevy Chase quoting him in Caddyshack, really.
That's right.
One of the greatest directors of all time, Alfred Hitchcock, passed away. You guys, Scott, you obviously are because you're a big horror suspense guy, but the rest of you guys big Hitch fans?
Yes, I love the show and some of the movies.
Which one's your favorite, Johnny? Which one you say?
Oh, Psycho, of course. Mm-hmm. But I love the show. I love the show a lot.
Mm-hmm. I have to say mine's probably... I like Psycho, but I would say mine's a tie between... It's a three-way tie between The Birds, North by Northwest, and Rope.
Oh, okay.
Are probably my three favorite Hitchcock movies.
What about you, G?
I'm not a horror guy, so.
Oh, okay.
I mean, obviously Psycho. I mean, mm-hmm. That I've seen. But...
I like
Strangers. And he hates that British accent, too.
I like
that.
I'm quite curious. I like Strangers on a Train, Rear Window. I still have to see Lifeboat. That's one of the ones I haven't seen yet. And he's very famous for the director cameos. It started off as necessity. They need an extra body, and he was the only one available that day of shooting. But then it became like a joke quote-unquote Easter egg on like where he was going to do it. And when he was making Lifeboat, people, like fans, wondered how he was going to make his cameo. And I don't know if you guys remember the movie at all. Do you remember Lifeboat, if you've seen it, where his cameo is?
Not really.
So, no, I don't remember. So that. Lifeboat, they're basically stuck in a boat, as far as I know. But he was on the newspaper. Like, the front page of the newspaper was a picture of him. So that's how he did it. He snuck his cameo in there. Last one was in Family Plot. So, yeah, Alfred Hitchcock. Too bad it's not there, but if any of you have been to Universal Studios... In Florida, at least. I think they probably did in California, but they had the Alfred Hitchcock, the making of the movies, and they actually showed you how some of the effects were done, like in Psycho and in Rear Window, and I think it was Strangers on a Train, too. They kind of showed you other camera tricks that he would employ. So it was a lot of fun. Henry Miller, the author. The great, great Peter Sellers. We lost him at the age of 55.
Yeah, very young.
Mm-hmm. Now, big Pink Panther guys, of course, Yes. Who's not?
Yes. Inspector Clouseau, yeah.
Absolutely. It is a bum.
That was a big blow to the movie studio, because those movies were still they were still very popular. Mm-hmm. And as we're going to see, they tried to crank a couple out with some lost footage and stuff. So that was a real big blow, because that was big money, the Pink Panther films. A lot of sequels, and they were still making money.
Does your dog get bite? I thought you said your dog get bite.
My dog.
The original.
Go ahead.
That is not my dog.
The original Pink Panther had him in it. But the second Pink Panther movie, actually, Alan Arkin was Clouseau. And when they realized that didn't fly, and Alan Arkin's a funny guy, they went back to Peter Sellers. And of course, he went on the run. But yeah, he didn't do every single Pink Panther movie. The second Pink Panther movie, I don't remember the name of it, Alan Arkin was Clouseau. And it just wasn't as funny. I mean, it was good, but it wasn't
great. Yeah, it was called Inspector Clouseau was the name, but yeah.
Yeah, it was decent, but it wasn't great. And then they brought Peter Sellers back.
What about,
of course, Peter Sellers, Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about Dr. Strangelove?
That's awesome. Well, it's Kubrick. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And then his last movie before passing away was Being There, which I think he won an Oscar for.
Yes.
We talked about in the last episode. Mm-hmm. There's a smoke show in that. Is it Shirley MacLaine? It was like one of her last hot roles. That's a good movie, though. And then I think he was sick. I think he announced he was sick right after that. He died of cancer. That's what he died of. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was a tough loss. John's right. He was shitting money. He was a big time moneymaker for studios. So that was a tough loss in many ways.
All right. And then the actor Strother Martin died.
Yes. Slapshot. Mm-hmm. And Cool Hand Luke, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
One of the famous lines he uttered, right? What we have here is failure to communicate.
We got here is failure to communicate.
Every time I hear that, I suddenly start hearing Slash's intro to Guns N' Roses Civil War.
So, you just can't reach.
Just can't reach.
I don't need your Civil War. Anyway, the great cartoonist Tex Avery passed away.
It sounded like Slim Pickens when you're singing that.
Well, we were talking about Dr. Strangelove a minute ago.
That is true. Yeah.
Anyway, William Buckwheat Thomas, one of the Little Rascals.
Okay.
Which famously played by Eddie Murphy coming up. Well, we'll talk about that. I think he plays it a couple years later from, I'm trying to remember what year that whole Who Shot Buckwheat thing, because I think that was a parody of Who Shot JR.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The great actor Steve McQueen, one of the Golden Age stars there. Mae West, the starlet from the early days of movies. Somebody who we definitely have to spend a good amount of time on, which we'll do when Mr. Criscolo does our music section later in the show. It's John Lennon, unfortunately murdered. And Colonel Harlan Sanders, that's right, of KFC fame, passed away in 1980. Now,
Shawn Michaels isn't Colonel Sanders? Damn.
Neither is Dolph Ziggler.
Neither is Dolph Ziggler or Jason Alexander.
Oh, I hated the Colonel with his wee beady eyes and the smug look on his face. Oh, you're going to buy my chicken. Oh, no. So I marry an ex-murderer. Okay. Anyway, notable births in 1980. We had Macaulay Culkin, Kristen Bell, Zooey Deschanel, Channing Tatum, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Ellie Kemper, Jason Segel, Kim Kardashian, but Gisele Bündchen. There you go for you, Jersey Shore, Paulie D, and somebody who a lot of Place of Nation is probably familiar with is Katie Morgan. In music, just got that one.
took me a minute. I was looking at something.
Yeah. Music, we had Christina Aguilera, T.I., Jessica Simpson, Ashanti, Nick Carter. In the world of sports, Albert Pujols, Ronaldinho, the soccer player, Sue Bird, Abby Wambach, Tony Romo, Yao Ming, Paul Gasol, Venus Williams, Richard Jefferson, Mark Teixeira, C.C. Sabathia, Antonio Gates, Michelle Kwan, Jenny Fitch. And, of course, what would be a Place Be Nation show without talking a little wrestling? But some of the wrestlers born in 1980, Randy Orton, Shayna Baszler, Dolph Ziggler, Shinsuke Nakamura, The Miz, Michelle McCool, David Otunga, Beth Phoenix, Wade Barrett, Cesaro, Christy Hemme, Mikey Whiplash, Carl Anderson, Connor, Victor. So amazing that, you know, Randy Orton looks way older than Shayna Baszler and Beth Phoenix, but they're amazingly the same age. So that's going to wrap up our pop culture section and over to Mr. Criscolo for the sports of 1980.
Thank you, Andy. And yes, 1980, a new decade dawns, which means we'll be seeing a lot of endings of dynasties and epic teams in sports that dominated the 70s, and we'll see teams emerge in the 80s. We'll start in baseball. The Hall of Fame had four go in. Al Kaline, legendary hitter for the Tigers. Chuck Klein. Duke Snyder, one of the three great New York center fielders. I think he was the last of the three to go in. I think Mickey and Willie were already in, so Duke Snyder was the last. And Tom Yawkey, of course, the former executive slash owner of the Boston Red Sox, who would have had no problem keeping Mookie Betts and spending money on him. in the World Series, well, let's do the division winners first. The Yankees won the East again. The Royals won the West again. The Phillies won the East again. Well, they were going back and forth with the Pirates. And the Astros, who had no trash cans in the dugout, won the NL West in a dogfight with the – in fact, I think that was the year they had a one-game playoff with the Dodgers, if I remember correctly. And
The Phillies series was one of the greatest championship series of all time. The Phillies won 105 games. The Astros had a 2-1 lead and lost their last two games at home. I guess they didn't have the Philly signs.
That's right.
They weren't cheating back then in 1980. Yep. But that was a tremendous series. And Gary Maddox,
their nipples.
Gary Maddox had such a great series. He was all over center field, made a lot of great catches. As a matter of fact, after the series was over, they carried him off the field. His teammates.
Yep. Absolutely. Your individual winners, George Brett won the AL MVP. Mike Schmidt, Michael Jack Schmidt, won the NL MVP.
Steve Stone, AL Championship Series, I believe it was, it only went three games, I believe. And in game three, if you look into the sky, George Brett's ball off Bruce Gossage is still traveling. It hasn't landed
years
later.
That's right.
Steve Stone of the Orioles won the AL Cy Young. Steve Carlton.
He had pine tar on his bat.
That's right. Well, not for a while. Yeah. well, Bob Lemon wasn't looking in 19. Well, actually, wasn't the man. We'll talk about who the manager of the Yankees was in a minute. And Steve Howe. Well, Joe Charbonneau won the AL Rookie of the Year for the Indians. And Steve Howe won the NL Rookie of the Year for the Dodgers, speaking of a future Yankee. He had other issues. I think he was best friends with Dale Barra. Of course, the World Series was the Phillies and the Royals, and it was the Phillies winning the series 4-2. As great a series as Gary Maddox had in that NLCS is as bad a World Series as Willie Wilson had. Willie Wilson at the time set a World Series record by striking out 10 times in 6 games. Great player, too, but had a rough series.
And unfortunately, George Brett, I think, missed the game. He had an ailment that he had to miss a game.
Yeah, didn't he have a hemorrhoid or something?
Yes,
he had a hemorrhoid. Imagine that. Oh, God. By the way, I should mention this because we do have an alum in present, because I'll have to mention the other fucking guy later. But Dennis Leonard, Iona alum, was a starter for the
Oh, Royals. Yeah, it's a decent pitcher.
He was a ghoul. He was a New Rochelle ghoul.
yes, there's a plaque for him up at the Sports Center down in Iona.
Schmitty won the World Series MVP, and this was back when I wasn't deep into sports yet. I loved the Expos at the time. I didn't dive into my current team yet, but I did like the Expos because the colors were cool. But
God, you're such a girl.
But
wow, 6 years old. Well, you were too busy already. You already had your fifth job by the time you were six. So you know,
you were already working till 1 o'clock in the morning at 6 years old, tending bar, doing pouring PBRs. Dallas Green was your manager of the Phillies. Jim Fry was your manager of the Royals. And speaking of Royals managers, 5 years later, the Royals would win the World Series with a manager by the name of Dick Houser. Why that is, why I'm saying that right now is because the manager of the New York Yankees in 1980 was Dallas Green. I mean, was Dick Houser, and the Yankees won 103 games that year. But George Steinbrenner, in one of 10 years worth of stupid
Nations fired him because he didn't win in the postseason. How fucking stupid. And 5 years later, he would win. I think that was the continuing incestuous situation with Billy Martin, although Billy at the time was managing out in Oakland, I think, right? Was he managing in 80? Yeah, he was, because he was in the postseason in 81. So, of course, Billy was managing the A's.
So get it all in now.
Oh, well, we've been kissing your team's ass for the last four fucking episodes. It's time to get back to reality.
34 years of mistakes, but that's okay.
Oh, speaking of, this was – speaking of my owners, quote unquote, this is the first of two of my sports teams in 1980 that were bought by somebody. Because the New York Mets, we don't care what their record was in 1980 because it was fairly terrible, but they are sold for $21.1 million to a group headed by Nelson Doubleday Jr. and some other fucking scumbag and his fucking scumbag son. Which, by the way, $21.1 million, highest amount paid for an American professional sports franchise at the time. They were probably more worth 21 cents at that time. But in any event, the Payson family, Joan Payson, who, of course, owned the team for years and years and years and years. She passed away, and the family sold it to Mr. Doubleday. And yes,
could you imagine that $21 million was the most, and now franchises are worth billions?
I know. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that funny that the Mets were probably worth more than the Yankees at the time? Probably because Steinbrenner, I don't know how much. I mean, think about it. 7 years earlier, when we did the 73 episode, he paid how much for the Yankees? $5 million or something, or $6
million?
$10 million, I think. Yeah, so...
another big year of big action for the Mets happened that year also, though.
Yes, in the draft, the very first thing the franchise did after the purchase, with the number one pick in the draft, they selected a lanky, power-hitting machine out of Crenshaw High School in East L.A. by the name of Daryl Strawberry, of which I have two jerseys. Mm-hmm. And the beginning of the renaissance for the New York Metropolitan Baseball Club would begin. So elsewhere in baseball, George Brett, on September 20th, he was hitting .400. He could have sat, but George Brett doesn't sit. He went 0 for 4, and his average dropped below .400. He finished with a batting average of .390. What a stud. Speaking of selling and buying, the Oakland A's sold from crazy Charlie Finley to Walter Haas. So Charlie Finley's run as owner of the A's came to an end, which included his cheap skateness led to free agency, and he used orange baseballs at one point. So at least George Steinbrenner didn't use orange baseballs or something. That would have been hilarious. And on November 4th of that year, Sataharu Oh retired from baseball. The Babe Ruth of Japan finished with 868 home runs, none of them medicinally enhanced. if you look at Sadahara Oh, I think Shinsuke Nakamura weighs more than Sadahara Oh. In basketball, the NCAA tournament, the Louisville Cardinals, led by one of my favorite nicknames of all time, Daryl Griffith. Nickname was, do you remember, Johnny? Daryl Griffith's
nickname? Dr. Duncanstein.
Dr. Duncanstein. Great fucking name. Kicked ass. Louisville beat UCLA 59-54. Iowa and Purdue were the other teams in the Final Four. And the game took place at Market Square Arena in Indianapolis. In the draft that year, the 1980 NBA draft, the number one pick overall was a guy that played in this Final Four, Joe Barry Carroll, who was a forward center for Purdue, was drafted by the Golden State Warriors. With the number three pick in the draft, the Minnesota Golden Gophers had their big guy, Kevin McHale, drafted by the Celtics. Kiki Vandeweghe was drafted by Dallas. He would eventually do better with the Portland Trailblazers and eventually play, of course, for the New York Knickerbockers. And with the 25th pick in the draft, all right, I'll say it, Andy, two Iona guys in one fucking show. They're never going to get ever again. So
no,
you know.
I'm savoring it.
Jeff Ruland would be drafted. He was a good player at Iona, decent coach, except his last year when they went 1-26. Good player here. Three NBA Hall of Famers were in that class that year. Jerry Lucas, who, of course, played for the Knicks. The Big O, Oscar Robertson, and the Logo. Jerry West. In the NBA Finals, in his rookie year, Magic Johnson and the Los Angeles Lakers win their first NBA title since 1972. They beat Dr. J and the Philadelphia 76ers 4-2. That series would be well known for Game 6 at the Spectrum, because in Game 5 at the Forum, Kareem, who was still the man on this team, I think he won the MVP that year, turned his ankle.
and he did win the MVP. And did not play Game 6. Magic played center, scored 42 points, and the Lakers won the world championship.
And Scott, even though that game was in Philly on the East Coast here, that game was shown at 11:30 p.m. on tape delay.
Yeah,
isn't that crazy? On CBS, that's how popular basketball was at the time.
Crazy, absolutely crazy, out of control. How the NBA was just a big mess of coke and other things.
Larry Bird won Rookie of the Year. And Bill Fitch won Coach of the Year because the Celtics were terrible in 79. And then, of course, Bird's rookie year, everything changed. The league officially adopted the three-point shot. So that's a big deal for the NBA. Now the three-pointer is an integral part of any offense. The Jazz left New Orleans and moved to Salt Lake City to become the Utah Jazz, which to this day still makes no sense. But to me, they'll always be the Utah Jazz. And my second
sports team is bought by somebody. Because Dr. Jerry Buss, a doctor from Wyoming, bought the Lakers from, pretty sure it was the Cook family, because Jack Kent Cook, who was a former owner of the Redskins, owned the Lakers as well. In fact, he helped build the Forum. This season is the year that the league pretty much, came into its own and became a integral national sport, mostly because of Bird and Magic. And we'll talk about that more as we move ahead. In the NFL, let's talk about the beginning of the year and the end of a dynasty. Super Bowl 14 from the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, the fourth and final Super Bowl championship for the Pittsburgh Steelers of the dynasty. They beat the LA Rams 31-19. Rams actually led in that game at the end of the third quarter, 19-17. And Bradshaw threw a nice pass to John Stallworth, one of my favorite Steelers of all time. And the Steelers won their fourth Super Bowl in, 7 years or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Beat the Rams. Terry Bradshaw was the MVP.
Vince Ferragamo was the Rams quarterback.
Yes, he was.
Them over those scumbag Cowboys in the playoffs.
That is true. That would, of course, Vince. be Roger Staubach's last season. He would retire at the end of that season. And so would begin a very long, long decade of the 80s for the Dallas Cowboys. Division winners, Buffalo, Cleveland, San Diego, one in the AFC, Houston and Oakland, the wild cards, Philadelphia, Minnesota, Atlanta, Dallas, and L.A. were the wild cards. This is the following season. This is why Johnny's right. We get confused. The 1980 season, of course, would start September that year. Those are your division winners. The Eagles were the Super Bowl, were the the NL East. NFC East, sorry, winners. Brian Sipe was your league MVP.
What? Chuck Knott, Coach of the Year, et cetera, et cetera. Major rule changes. Among the rule changes, throwing a backward pass out of bounds was not allowed. Elsewhere, a 10-second runoff will be implemented when a team commits... all these things. So a 10-second runoff will be implemented when a team commits the following actions to conserve time within the last minute of the half or overtime: intentional grounding, illegal forward pass, et cetera, et cetera. Teams can't take a timeout to prevent the runoff. No more clubbing in the face. That personal foul can be called whether or not the initial contact was made below the neck. And guidelines for captain section was added to the rules. And also, over the next couple of years,
Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, wanted to leave Oakland and go to L.A.
That season, of course, 1980, the league voted 22-0 to not allow them to move. Davis said, fuck you, I'm moving anyway. So the next 2 years have that kind of a mess for the NFL involving Pete Rozelle and Al Davis would butt heads over the next few years for that. In NCAA football, Ohio State was the preseason number one. But Georgia won the national championship with arguably my favorite non-Notre Dame college player of all time. Yes, Chad Campbell, Mr. Herschel Walker, who would win the Heisman 2 years later. Herschel finished third as a freshman. Your winner that year was George Rogers, running back out of South Carolina. And Georgia would win the national championship. Actually, they beat Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl to do that. Let us go to hockey. And
that was the last championship that Georgia has ever won.
Yeah.
They've choked in every big game since then.
That is pretty pretty much that's the truth.
We also had some great draft picks too, Scott.
There were a few draft picks. Let's go. What did I do with the draft picks? Oh, they're up here. The number one pick was Billy Sims of the Detroit Lions from Oklahoma. Johnny Lamb Jones of the Jets was the number two pick.
Oh, what a bust.
Yep.
Except they traded up for him.
Yep. And who did the Jets not draft that went number three?
Well, Anthony Munoz went number three.
One of the greatest offensive linemen in history of the game.
Of all time. Yep. Art Monk went 18th. Dwight Stevenson, another Hall of Famer, went 48th. And Mongo, hey baby, fuck, went number 73 to the Patriots, actually. And then, of course, he would beat them years later in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, the Jets traded up. They thought they were going to pair Lamb Jones with Wesley Walker. They were going to have a dominant receiving corps.
Oh, yeah, they thought.
Lamb Jones crapped out. Yeah.
Typical. Dave Craig went undrafted. That's because he was 5'1". But, of course, he would end up playing a little. NFL Hall of Fame class that year, Herb Adderley, former Packer corner. Deacon Jones, speaking of head slaps. Bob Lilly, thank you. Great. The first Cowboy draft pick in franchise history.
Who cares?
Jim Otto, the legendary. Jim Otto, the legendary center for the Raiders. All right, now we'll get to hockey.
Jim Otto, and the first guy whose last name you spelled the same backwards and forwards. So.
That's right.
John, and his
Johnny, I keep trying to delay hockey. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Anything else? What do we got? We talk about Iona Tiddlywinks next.
Jim Otto didn't know whether he was coming or going.
Before we get to the season, four teams from the disbanded WHA joined the NHL, the Edmonton Oilers, the Winnipeg Jets, the Quebec Nordiques, and the New England Whalers, who, of course, played here in Hartford. But thanks to the team that owns the region, the hub themselves, the Boston Bruins, said, fuck that shit, they got to be called the Hartford Whalers.
And actually, hey, a bunch of massholes.
It sounds better anyway.
Exactly.
In any case, the 79-80 season included an unprecedented 35-game unbeaten streak by the Philadelphia Flyers. They started the season with a 5-2 win over the Islanders, then a 9-2 loss to the Flames, and then did not lose a game for almost 3 months, earning at least 1 point in every game. Between a 4-3 win over Toronto on October 14th, 1979, and a 4-2 win over Buffalo on January 6th, 1980. So in a 35-game stretch, the Flyers went 25-0-10.
Oof.
Not bad. They would make it all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals, where they would take on the New York
Islanders from Long Island.
Yes.
But you skipped the playoffs, Scott, where the heavily favored Bruins were up against the Islanders, and the big bad Bruins were bragging about how they were going to beat up and easily beat those Long Island pussies. and what happened? Clark Gillies, Bobby Nystrom, and Islanders not only outscored them, they really put a beat down on them. And our Boston Bruins expert Peter Winston will even admit to this. He says he watches this game on YouTube. The Long Island pussies put a beat down on those Bruins.
First of all, I won in six games. I just got a message from Peter Winston. He said that the referees should not have allowed all of that fighting.
That's typical Boston fan.
Too busy watching Chief J Strongbow matches. And
and Paul Orndorff
and Greg Valentine. Yes, you are correct. The Bruins did lose.
And the Flyers were favored though in the fight. And also interesting to note that they seeded the playoffs were all by seed, and that's why you had all these weird matchups, and that's why you had Islanders and Flyers in the finals.
I know.
They just did it by seed. Yeah. And it went to a game six, and game six was on a Saturday afternoon. It was even though there wasn't a national TV contract at the time, CBS had the game nationally, and the Islanders won in overtime in game six.
Yes, they did with a goal by
Bobby Nystrom,
who was one of the first players to ever play for the New Haven Nighthawks. So I'm very proud of that. Of course, I mean this Islander team was loaded. Brian Trottier, Clark Gillies, Mike Bossy, Bobby Nystrom, John Tinelli, Billy Smith, one of the greatest goalies. And you could say, Johnny, Pop Van sucks.
Where's the whistles?
Oh, God. Of course, Philadelphia had Reggie Leach, Bobby Clark, great player. And Trottier won the league MVP. Also in 1979-80 season, John Ziegler announced that protective helmets would be made mandatory for all NHL players, except at the time of the rule, only 70% of NHLers were already wearing helmets. There were a few players that could choose to sign to wear a helmet and sign a waiver. The first player ever to wear protective headgear on a regular basis was George Owen of the Bruins in 1928. The last guy to wear a helmet to be helmetless is Craig McTavish for the Blues in 1996-97. The guy that I remember the most as a kid that didn't wear a helmet was Rod Langway, who used to play for the Caps. I always remember him not having a helmet.
That was about hockey players. You know, they were tough, but they all had the pretty hair. You know, with Ron Duguay.
No teeth.
Yeah. Bobby Nystrom, we talked about. You remember the movie, like, you know, Youngblood and all that, with all of them with their flowy, their hair going down the thing.
Flowing,
like,
locks.
That was like a thing for hockey players back in the day.
Absolutely. In golf, Jack Nicklaus won two of the four majors. Tom Watson was the money winner. Three different horses won the three Triple Crown races. In tennis, Bjorn Borg won two of the four majors. He won yet another Wimbledon. Chris Evert won two of the four women's Grand Slams. Johnny Rutherford won the Indy 500. Buddy Baker won Daytona. And in his first NASCAR points championship, the dominator himself, Dale Earnhardt. And this was back. Dale did not have – he actually had a different number, and he didn't have the black olds. He had a red, blue and yellow car, which had Wrangler on it, and his number was 2. He wouldn't get the number 3 in the black Oldsmobile, otherwise known as the Dominator, it was the Intimidator. I always get that confused. I think it's the Intimidator down the line. So 1980 was a year for other sports besides the big ones. Two of the greatest boxing match. Well, one great boxing match and then one kind of sad boxing match. We'll talk about the great one first. The sequel between two of the greatest middleweights of all time, Sugar Ray Leonard and Hands of Stone Roberto Duran, fought at the Superdome in New Orleans on November 25th, 1980. It was the second of three bouts between the pair. The first fight earlier in the year was in Montreal at Old Olympic Stadium. Roberto Duran won that fight. And this was the infamous fight where Duran said, "No mas, no mas." Now, he to this day still denies he did that, but, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I watched this fight, obviously, years later when I was a kid. I fucking hate Sugar Ray Leonard. So I was kind of bummed that Roberto Duran lost. But begrudgingly, Sugar Ray Leonard is one of the greatest fighters of all time. But I always consider him like the early version of Floyd Mayweather. He never really stuck in and punched anybody. He kind of bobbed and weaved and danced and acted like a dick in the ring. But he wasn't a guy like Roberto Duran who could throw bombs. But he got the better of Duran in that game, in that fight. And Roberto Duran said, "No mas." And then this fight, which is really sad to think about, because after watching the 30 for 30, the fight should never have happened. It was called The Last Hurrah. It took place on October 2nd, 1980, in Vegas, and it was between the heavyweight champion Larry Holmes and Muhammad Ali. Ali had not fought in a little bit. Larry Holmes was the champ from Easton, Pennsylvania, and it's on YouTube. Obviously, I didn't watch it live. I'm sure you guys probably didn't either. It's uncomfortable to watch. It's uncomfortable.
My dad talking about this when I was younger.
Yeah,
that it made you feel bad for Muhammad Ali. That's all. Yeah, I mean, and Larry Holmes didn't want to keep hitting him.
No, and we were talking about it beforehand. At one point, and you see it on the 30. By the way, watch the 30 for 30 about this fight. It breaks your heart. At one point, Larry Holmes looks at the ref and goes, "Why are you not stopping this? I don't want to hit him anymore." And the referee's just looking at him, and so he just kept hitting him. It was bullshit. The whole thing was bullshit. It was all about making money. Apparently, Ali needed money. I don't know if it was a Don King thing. Who the hell knows?
but Muhammad Ali had no business being in the ring again. He'd still fight again. It wasn't even his last match. His last fight, he'd fight again, I think, a couple times. It just is. It was sad. It was really sad to see one of the greatest of all time look so pathetic in the ring. Really sad. And 1980, of course, was a year for the Olympics. And we will only talk about the Summer Olympics, the Winter Olympics, because the United States would boycott the Summer Games in Moscow because, of course, we had our issues with the Russians. So we'll talk about the Summer Games, the Winter Games, which took place in the winter, in Lake Placid, upstate New York. Eric Heiden, great speed skater, won a ton of medals. But, of course, the 1980 Winter Olympics will always be remembered for the Miracle on Ice, which, of course, was the ragtag bunch of U.S. Olympic hockey players from colleges from Minnesota to North Dakota to Massachusetts to Vermont to everywhere, coached by the great Herb Brooks, who I think, Johnny, didn't he coach the Rangers?
Yep.
You did, right?
Didn't he coach the Rangers? Yeah. Had some success too. Won a few playoff series, sure.
Yeah. Earlier in that year, in 79, the Russians played the Americans in an exhibition game at the Garden and beat them 10-3. So, of course, no one expected the U.S. to do anything. The Russians could have beaten two-thirds of the NHL at this point. I mean, they were just a fucking machine at this point. They had Larionov. They had a bunch of other guys, and Tretiak was probably the best goalie in the world. And when they faced each other in the semifinals, this was not for the gold medal; it was the semifinals. One of the most watched events ever. It was on tape delay, which is even more ridiculous. You know, today,
it was in the afternoon. The game was in the afternoon, and. But they played it on prime time,
yep.
8 o'clock. So because I remember I was watching the news or the sports section because I figured, no big deal. You know, the Russians probably smoked them and stuff. And the sportscast even said, if you don't want to know the game, cover your ears or whatever. But I still listen because I just figured he'd say, oh, the Russians beat them 8-3. But then he said the U.S. won. I was like, oh, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Then I watched it that night. It was incredible. But like you said, Scott, that was only the semifinals. They still had this was a Friday, and they still had to go Sunday morning. They had to beat Sweden for the gold on Sunday morning.
Yes.
Let's. Yeah. So it was just so that night, Russians took a 1-0 lead. U.S. tied it, and then right before the end of the period, I think it was Dave Christian. Would score a goal, and the U.S. would take – or no, the game would be tied. It was 1-0 the Russians, and then the U.S. tied it like with 2 seconds left in the period. And then the head coach of Russia did one of the dumbest things that you could ever do. He benches Tretiak.
Yep.
And puts in his backup, who wasn't a bad goalie either, but that's like the Devils in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals.
Take it out
benching
Brodeur,
Marty Brodeur. Yeah. I mean, utterly the stupidest thing you could possibly do. And eventually a Mike Ruzioni goal late. And then the last – and Mike Ruzioni says it. That was with 9 minutes and 20 seconds left in the game.
And he said those 9 minutes and 20 seconds felt like 9 years.
And the Russians – to Jim Craig's credit, the Russians just pummeled him in those last 9 minutes with shot after shot after shot after shot. And he did not bend. And the Russians and the U.S. won 4-3, and I was 6 years old, and that was the first time that I ever saw my father cry. I figure my dad was in his how old was he at that point? 34. Or something. He was in his late 40s, and he's about my age, I guess. And he watched all that stuff with the Russians and the Cold War through all those years. And 20 years earlier, the U.S. had beat them for the gold once before in Squaw Valley. But this is a big moment for a couple of reasons. The country was in the dumps. We just had a lousy last couple of years of a president. Inflation was high. We had hostages in Iran. The country was in the toilet.
And the Cold War was starting.
The Cold War was starting or continuing, really.
Continuing, yeah.
detente was not really – was starting to thaw. But this was a moment for us to stand tall as a country. I still think it's the greatest moment in the history of North American sports. Mm-hmm. And a big moment for us as a country. Now, of course, again, we would have – the Summer Olympics were in Moscow, and President Carter boycotted it because of the Russians' invasion of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So we would have no Summer Olympics. So
It was actually Finland that they beat in the gold medal game. And one of the greatest, most famous lines was by Al Michaels.
Yes.
Do you believe in miracles?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, I've actually absolutely been in that arena. When I was a PA at the Outdoor Life Network, we were covering the Olympic trials for the 1998 games in Nagano, Japan. And I was sent up there to do some... to work on some shoots for like short track speed skating and everything. It was so bitterly cold. It was like a winter storm that the National Guard was there, but I was in the 1980 arena, they call it. And first thing I did was I looked at my boss and I said, all right, which side did Ruzioni score on? And he pointed out to me and he was like, very few things that you could have said it better your first time being inside this arena. So yeah, I felt it when I was in there. Sorry, Scott. I mean,
that's something. Mm-hmm. 40th anniversary be coming up this year will be the 40th anniversary.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, the day
40 years.
The day will be about 2 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's now the hockey training center.
Yeah.
And they use that often. And of course, I think it's actually now called the Herb Brooks Arena because of course.
Well, I think there's two arenas in Lake Placid actually.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main. I think the main one they use is the one that was used for the game. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were two movies about this event. One was right after it happened in like 80, 81. I remember Steve Guttenberg played Jim Craig, I think.
Yeah, TV movie. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then of course the one that most people remember, and I'm looking at it right now on my shelf here in Studio B, was the movie Miracle. Which came out, I think, in 2004. Sadly, it came out right after Herb Brooks died. Herb Brooks had cancer.
Yeah.
And I never – every time I hear Dream On by Aerosmith now, that's what I think of, I think. And as much as I love the song anyway and the band. That movie, if you could find it somewhere – I don't know if it's on Disney Plus. I think it is. I think it's on Disney Plus.
For the 40th, NHL Network's been – playing, you know, cut up, but it's the NHL Network's playing it a shitload for the 40th anniversary.
Great.
I guess they got the rights to it.
It's fantastic, and Kurt Russell is killer as Herb Brooks, completely with the Minnesota accent.
Delivers a great speech.
Not today.
Yeah.
Not here.
Yep.
So awesome. You'll find it very hard for me to find another moment in North American sports that is as awesome as that.
Go ahead.
No, was that Andy?
No, he died in 2003 of actually a car accident in Minnesota.
Oh, I thought it was cancer. Okay, well, that's even more shocking. That's even more upsetting.
Because it was sudden. Because I remember I was at a softball game actually for my company, and one of my coworkers, I guess, heard on the radio on the ride over. First thing he comes up to me, goes, Herb Brooks died. I went, what? Yeah, he said, I knew I was a Ranger fan, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very sad. And the movie came out right after that, so. Very upsetting. But what a moment in the history of North American sports. And, yes, they beat Finland in the final and won the gold medal. We haven't come even close since. Well, I shouldn't say we haven't come close, but we would not win another one. And we wouldn't come close to getting this far in the medal round for quite a few years. So. And on that note, in what was a very epic and historic year in sports, I handed the shoe back to Mr. Atherton for a look at the boob tube in 1980.
That's right. Now, some of the top-rated programs. Now, we're talking about the 80 to 81 season. We had a little change. Not too many comedies or sitcoms in the top. Now we have Dallas, Dukes of Hazzard, which was one of my personal favorites at that time.
Everybody.
60 Minutes, a perennial top-rated news program, MASH, The Love Boat, The Jeffersons, Alice, something called House Calls, which I can't really recall, Three's Company, Little House on the Prairie, One Day at a Time,
fucking Dr. G list here.
Yeah, Real People, Archie Bunker's Place, Magnum P.I., Happy Days, Too Close for Comfort, Fantasy Island, Trapper John, Different Strokes, Monday Night Football, Laverne and Shirley, That's Incredible, Heart to Heart, the Sunday Night Movie, Chips, Facts of Life. Some of the shows that ended in 1980 was Spider-Woman, Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo, The Rockford Files, which was one of my grandmother's personal favorites, Hawaii Five-O, Hello Larry, which I think only started right before that.
I know, right?
And Barnaby Jones, another one of my grandmother's favorites, Angie and Dinah. Now, now we look at the premieres of 1980, 3-2-1 Contact. That was one of
those. What a show. Mm-hmm. Love that show. Watched it every day after school.
That,
love 3-2-1.
You had the, as you like to say it, the trifecta or whatever you want to say it, of Sesame Street, Electric Company, and 3-2-1 Contact.
Yes.
So your children's absolutely. Programming, education, everything, all in entertaining packages. Now, all these shows. Yes, that's incredible.
Actually, Andy, quickly, we should make it actually a grand slam because you have to put Mr. Rogers in there, too.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Put Mr. Rogers in there, too.
The quartet.
Quartet. Okay. Grand slam.
So we had That's Incredible, which was that was kind of when, between that and Real People, they were really competing against each other. You know, Real People was on NBC, That's Incredible was on ABC, to, like, you know, have these personalities and talk about people that were just real, so to speak, no pun intended. They actually launched a whole network later, back in my early days, called CBS Ion People, that all it played was these kind of shows, that and Charles Corral. So the network actually didn't last very long in the late 90s. Then we had the Tim Conway Show. We had a couple of spinoffs here. Tim Conway Show, Flow, which was a spinoff of Alice, maybe Nobody's Perfect, The Lone Ranger. Here's a show we all watched on Saturday, Solid Gold.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Solid Gold Dancers.
Andy Gibb, Marilyn McCoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Heathcliff, Thundar the Barbarian, featuring Ookla the Mock.
And Ariel.
Ookla, Ariel, ride.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Ladies Man, It's a Living.
You know what I love about It's a Living? You know what I love about It's a Living? The circular salad bar.
Yes.
Love this. And that was my first look at Ann Jillian. The circular salad bar. And Ann Jillian, she was hot.
Yes. And we had another great show, Too Close for Comfort.
Oh, yeah, I love that show.
Ted Knight. My brother and I used to write down, G will find this not shocking whatsoever, but I used to make a list of all of Ted Knight's college sweatshirts to see if he ever repeated them. That's a me thing.
G's not surprised. Yeah.
No, I'm not surprised.
Well, Bobby Heenan went on to do that, didn't he, in the primetime wrestling?
He did in the later primetimes in 91, 92? Yeah, he definitely did. Yeah.
See, I remember things about wrestling once in a while. Once in a while, yeah. Don't get me in a trivia contest, though.
Monroe was G's favorite character. Jim J. Bullock. He's a big fan of Jim J. Bullock's work.
My favorite. How'd you guess?
Which one of the sisters' names? Which one did you like better? Deborah von Valkenburg, right? That was one of them from.
Nah, the blonde with the big hands. What are you kidding me?
Lydia Cornell, I think her name.
Ah, yes.
Deborah von Valkenburg, of course, was in the Warriors.
Warriors, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, but the blonde, she was a little like looked a little like Suzanne Somers.
You did?
Yeah, with the cans too.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at her IMDb. Yep. Good gravy. Oh, good God. Anyway, and then we had another spinoff from the Deuce Vader, Enos, which was the nice guy who was Daisy Duke was always trying to charm, and he was kind of clueless with her. And then you had Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters, the variety show, which they were nice to look at. And then Bosom Buddies premiered in 1980, the start of Tom Hanks, Pierce Scolari, Holland Taylor was on that show. Wendy Jill Sperver, great actors and actresses.
Oh, gee, why don't you let Andy know what the theme song was for Bosom Buddies?
Only in the first season.
What do you think? Then you had a karaoke version of it.
Yeah, a cheap knock. Yeah, they only used Billy's version for the for the pilot, and then of course ABC's like, I'm not paying for this, and then they did a cheap knockoff of it after that.
There you go.
Well, like you're saying, only the first season. I think the show was only two seasons.
There you go.
just enough.
Great show.
Here we go.
Actually, great.
Hold on, Andy. We have to have our Billy Joel segment. Is it true that when he says, "I got a call from a friend from the West Coast," that's supposedly Richard Lewis?
I don't know. I've never actually seen that. Gee, do you know that or not? I'm not sure.
Now he gives him a stand-up routine in L.A. Supposedly that's Richard Lewis is his friend.
No kidding.
I figured you guys would know that.
Richard Lewis, he wishes he had Richard Lewis's hair.
That's kind of shocking. Like, it's like actually believing that You Ought to Know is written about Dave Coulier. So, but
yeah, that's true too.
Also, Freddie and the Bean and Magnum P.I., the great,
yes.
You know.
Oh, what a show.
Yes.
Freebie and the Bean. What a funny show. Mm-hmm. Magnum P.I. is awesome.
Some of the big-time made-for-TV movies and miniseries of 1980 was The Guiana Tragedy, The Story of Jim Jones, The Return of the King, Scarlett O'Hara, The Scarlett O'Hara War, and Shogun, which was pretty big in September.
Yep, I have that on Blu-ray.
Yep. I think we can't go like two movies without Scott saying, "I'm looking on my shelf. I'm looking at it right now."
It's Studio B.
It's Studio B.
It's Studio B.
All right. On your Saturday morning cartoons, we had Super Friends, the Plastic Man Comedy Adventure Show, Scooby and Scrappy-Doo, New Adventures of Mighty Mouse and Heckle and Jekyll, which you'll probably never, ever see on TV again, Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Show, the all-new Popeye Show, Fat Albert, Super Globetrotters, Casper and the Angels, Friend Barney Meet the Shmoo, the aforementioned Thundar the Barbarian, Godzilla, and Dinomutt. Oh, I love Dinomutt and Blue Falcon. What a funny show. Kind of a takeoff on Batman, Scooby-Doo, and Bionic Man all rolled in again. So we like to talk about one of our favorite shows, Saturday Night Live, which was season 6, 1980 to 81. Now, this was a kind of an interesting year for the show because, Lorne Michaels decided to take a year off because he cited burnout as his reason. And he learned from associate producer that the show would go on with or without him. And they had chosen a woman, Jean Dumanian, I think that's how you pronounce it, and as his replacement. And this was, he was angered by this move. The entire cast, all but one writer, followed Lorne out the door. Brian Doyle Murray was the only one that stuck around. So the sixth season started with a completely new cast, new writers, with a new showrunner, Denny Dillon, Gilbert Gottfried, Gail Mathias, Joe Piscopo, Anne Risley, Charles Rocket, all were the main cast, and Yvonne Hudson, Matthew Lawrence, Patrick Weathers as featured players. Some unknown performers that did not make the cut, Jim Carrey, John Goodman, Paul Rubens. So, they were looking for a, somebody to replace Garrett Morris to get that what they term in this article the more ethnic role. So they set up for 2 days in mid September, and they interviewed 30 black actors and comedians, and they fought through the writers' ring on the 17th floor of Rockefeller Center. In the end, she told her group that she was leaning towards hiring a stand up by the name of Charlie Barnett. But talent coordinator Neil Levy had another black performer he wanted her to see, a kid from Roosevelt, Long Island, named Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy.
That's right.
And just to add, legend has it that Charlie Barnett was heavily favored, but he had a little difficulty reading like cue cards or reading in general, so he kind of. That's what lost him out at the last minute. Otherwise, he was a shoo-in.
Yeah.
And if you ever seen a DC cab, Charlie Bunny, he's very funny in it. And then he's a very funny comedian who unfortunately died early of AIDS. But
oh, yeah. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody can perform live, especially having to read cue cards. It's one thing to be able to do a memorized stand-up routine, but to be able to sit there and stay in character and read cue cards, it's got. I give it to those performers.
Charles Rocket was they had high hopes for that. He was going to be like the next Bill Murray, mm-hmm. but it didn't work out. This turned out to be like the worst season of SNL ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the writing and the absence of Ebersol and the writing and the cast wasn't really too likable.
Yeah.
They just weren't funny.
Yeah, no.
They just weren't funny.
Yeah.
You know, the skits just weren't funny.
Yeah, yeah, the females were no Gilda Radner, Lorraine Newman. They were on the
They were big. So, they were big shoes to fill too, though. I mean, yeah. At the time, we look back now, but yeah, they were incredible talents. It's also stated that that Jean Dumanian, whatever her name was, preferred Robert Townsend, but she was convinced to add Eddie Murphy to the staff. It was never got back to its a lot of critics have written the show off as a pale imitation due to budget cuts, lack of support that was promised to the executive producer, and a competition from ABC's Fridays, which was enjoying critical acclaim and gaining popularity. But then, February 21st, the show featured a parody of Who Shot J.R. Ewing from the hit TV show Dallas in a cliffhanger titled Who Shot C.R.? Cast member Charles Rocket was quote unquote shot in the last sketch episode of the episode after a running gag in which other members of the cast shared their grievances on stage for the Good Night's Dallas star. And that weekend's host, Charlene Tilton, asked Charles Rocket, who was still in character and sitting in a wheelchair, on his thoughts on being shot. And he says, "Oh man, it's the first time I've been shot in my life." He replied, "I'd like to know who the fuck did it." The cast, along with some of the other audience members, reacted with laughter and surprise. Though this was not the first nor last time the expletive would be uttered on Saturday Night Live, Charles Rocket line, unbeknownst to him, would be the final straw that caused him and everyone else, save Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo, to be dismissed. The show would be Gene's last episode. This one was a train wreck, said then NBC president and CEO Fred Silverman. And the show's new logo, which was used only for one season, featured the words Saturday Night Live in a pink graffiti text. It was accompanied by in the 1980 episodes with 1980. SNL was given one more chance when Dick Ebersol, one of the original developers and the man responsible for hiring Lorne Michaels, was hired to replace Gene. And in the first week, Dick Ebersol fired Gilbert Gottfried, Anne Risley, Charles Rocket, replaced them with Tim Kazurinsky, Catherine O'Hara, and Tony Rosado. He had made offers to John Candy and Catherine O'Hara of SCTV to join the cast. John Candy turned down the offer, so Tony Rosado was added. Catherine O'Hara initially accepted, but changed her mind after Michael O'Donoghue, the show's head writer, had been brought in to rejuvenate the show, screamed at the cast about the season's poor writing and performances. Catherine O'Hara suggested Robin Duke as her replacement, and Duke was brought in. Catherine O'Hara never appeared as a cast member. Laurie Metcalf and Emily Prager joined as featured players. Dick Ebersol's first episode was on April 11th, 1981. After a Writers Guild strike forced the show into hiatus, it was extensively retooled. And before the next season, though, Ebersol also fired Denny Dillon and Gail Mathias, leaving Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo, again, as the last one standing. Could you believe that John Candy could have been on Saturday Night Live? What do you think that would have done? What do you think that would could have meant? Would he have been like the next Belushi, basically?
Not really. John Candy didn't have that. John Candy's a very funny guy, mm-hmm. but he didn't have that like dirty, gritty humor that John Belushi had.
Well, he wasn't mad. Don't forget,
you know, he was John Belushi was just a different guy. He was on another planet. But though this whole saga we've been talking about, the thing that I find most perplexing is where does Lorne Michaels get off thinking that I'm going to take the show with me on hiatus? Like, who the fuck are you, dude? If NBC said, all right, well, we're just going to have somebody – I mean, yeah, I'm sorry that you want to take a year off, and that's great, but we need to keep the show going, so we're bringing somebody else in. They have every right to do that. I don't know where Lorne Michaels thought that they would say, all right, don't worry about it. We'll just wipe the show out and put on crap for the next year. I mean, you can't do that.
Well, I mean, he probably, had a major, thought he was the man because he had this groundbreaking show on – Saturday nights, that was, critical acclaim and water cooler talk and building stars. And he's like, I'm a little tired. Then I'm going to take a break, so I'm going to take my show with me. No, that's not how it works.
That's not how it works.
A little break for his britches.
Yeah, and honestly, the rest of that cast, Bill and Gilda, and they were already – by this point, they had gotten too big for that show to begin with. They were already making movies and so I think they were all going to leave regardless. This just seemed more symbolic. But can you imagine if Eddie Murphy was not picked and Gene Dumanian's choice of Robert – and I like Robert Townsend. He's not a bad guy. He's okay. He's funny. But if they had not gotten Eddie, I don't think the show would ever have come back. to be honest.
Yeah.
He saved their ass. And Joe Piscopo, I mean, he's okay, but he's another one of those guys who I think he thinks is funnier than everybody else thinks he's funny. But, I mean, Eddie carried that show for the next, like, what, 3 years?
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever. We wouldn't get a great – we wouldn't really get a great SNL cast again until, like, 86 when we – when Dana and Kevin Nealon and Victoria Jackson, Jan, like, when the real, you know, real class came in.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I
Norm
think...
and Dennis Miller, you know, like that whole crew. Once they came in, the show was revitalized. But most of the next, like, 3 or 4 years would be a little shaky.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about when we get there. But, I mean, loved as a kid growing up the – and it was – you don't realize now – you know, you look back, like, that was only one season. It was, like, Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Christopher Guest, Jim Belushi, all those guys were there. And that was a pretty – a lot of memorable sketches came out of that year. But, yes, you're right, Scott, pretty much – but in terms of like an era coming in, that was like that whole the Dana, you know, Kevin Nealon, Mike Myers, Victoria Jackson, Nora Dunn, Jan Hooks. That class was incredible.
Yep. Yes. We'll get
there. This year was where the show was in the biggest jeopardy of getting canceled. There was only 13 shows this year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And with all the turmoil, there was a legitimate chance that the show was going to get canceled, but that's why Eddie Murphy is pretty much credited with saving Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, some of the people that hosted that year were Elliot Gould, Malcolm McDowell, Jamie Lee Curtis, David Carradine, Sally Kellerman, Robert Hayes, Charlene Tilton, and Bill Murray. And then, of course, the last episode under this regime was there was no host, actually, because of they didn't even know if the show was going to air that night. All right, yep. So the Primetime Emmy Awards took place September 7th of 1980. Hosted by Steve Allen and Dick Clark. Your outstanding comedy series was Taxi, over on the ABC Network. Outstanding drama series, Lou Grant. Outstanding comedy or music special, Baryshnikov on Broadway. Outstanding drama or comedy special was The Miracle Worker. And in terms of your acting awards, we had great lead actor in a comedy was Richard Mulligan from Soap. And a lead actress was Catherine Damon, also from Soap. Very, very funny show. Lead actor in a drama was Ed Asner from Lou Grant. And a lead actress in a drama series, Barbara Bel Geddes, Miss Ellie Mae, right?
Miss Ellie.
Miss Ellie from Dallas. Outstanding supporting actor in a comedy was Harry Morgan. Supporting actress in a comedy series was Loretta Swit, both from MASH. On your drama side, supporting actor went to Stuart Margolin of The Rockford Files. And supporting actress herself, Olivia, right? Soprano, Nancy Marchin for Lou Grant. That year, BET, Black Entertainment Television, launched in the United States as a block of programming on USA Network. In 1983, it becomes a full-fledged channel. Here's something I remember, too. February 14th, on CBS, Walter Cronkite announces his retirement from CBS Evening News to take effect on March 1981. That was like a huge deal. He was the most trusted newsman in America. And Dan Rather took over and lasted like... just as long, probably. So, you know, he delivered. I mean, think of what Cronkite delivered. You know, who shot Kennedy got shot, amongst others. This, you know, something that you
all
know,
the years during the Vietnam War, he would go to Vietnam. Yeah, no, definitely.
And that's when CBS pretty much ruled news.
Yeah,
you know, NBC was okay and ABC was okay, but that 6:30 block during the week, that was the big eye. It was all about the big eye. And that was because of him.
Yeah. Also that year, March 16th, the first regularly scheduled use of closed captioning on the American Network Television occurs on ABC. March 21st that year, the season finale of Dallas on CBS. J.R. Ewing is shot by an unseen assailant, leading to the catchphrase, "Who shot J.R.?" Now, that was a phenomenon because that would not be kept secret today. I mean, yeah, you know, stuff like Walking Dead and other movie, you know, plot twists, they are kept pretty secret, but... this was huge. This was everywhere. Do you guys remember that? How this kind of like gripped America and how people were guessing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who'd you guys? You know, did you guys watch Dallas at the time?
No.
Not real. I mean, I remember my parents watching it. So you know, and you know, just like I said, it was always in the news. You heard so much about it. So it kind of piqued my curiosity. I remember during that time, even though I didn't watch it every week.
Um, Yeah, no, I watched it. I thought it was Sue Ellen, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, she had motive.
He treated her like shit.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
Well, basically, everybody had motive because Jer was such a dick.
Yeah, it's true. Everybody could have should have shot him.
April 29th, the NFL draft is televised for the first time on ESPN. On May 6th, Ron Howard and Donnie Most leave the cast of Happy Days as regulars following the episode Ralph's Family Problem. When Happy Days returns in the fall, Henry Winkler is given the top billing in the opening credits. Now, what did you guys think of when they left? Do you think the show should have kept going? I mean, did it still have legs? I mean, yeah, we got, you know, more Fonzie. You know, that's when, you know, Chachi really became more of a prominent, along with Joni. Potsy was still around. So what did you guys think of when Ron Howard and Donnie Most left?
You know, when you watch it now, I mean, I think I have a better perspective of it now. You could see the storylines kind of and the writing kind of going down a little bit. But, you know, that happens, especially when you have characters that are in school, you know, and they get older. You have to do something to kind of, you know, bring back that magic that was in the beginning of the show, which is very hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it still did pretty well in the ratings for a few more years after, but it definitely was not the same show, you know, because I watch a lot of shows in, you know, syndication, and definitely the earlier seasons were better than after, you know, Richie and Ralph, you know, Ralph left.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember the series finale. That was Joni and Chachi's wedding. And there was a scene when they start playing Here Comes the Bride, and Richie and Lori Beth come out, and the crowd just goes berserk to see Richie there. So, yeah, he was beloved, but he Ron wanted to move on and become a director. That was really what it was about. August 1st, 24/7 cable movie network Cinemax launches. One thing I didn't say when we talked about the Emmys a minute ago was that the ceremony was held while a strike by the members of the Screen Actors Guild was in progress. And the show's support for their union, 51 of the 52 nominated performers boycotted the event. Powers Booth was the only nominated actor to attend. On November 18th, Suzanne Summers makes her final, quote-unquote, full appearance in an episode of the ABC sitcom Three's Company. Her remaining 7 appearances would be cameos in the episode's closing tag, where Chrissy would call from her parents' home in Fresno to speak with either Jack or Janet, who would sometimes fill in Chrissy on what's happening in the episode. That was... It's like, you know what? We're going to make you be in the episodes, but you get to be in a 2-minute scene in the end with nobody else. That was really...
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, some contract dispute. Yeah. Hey, you missed this letter. That was terrible. I missed those cans.
Big ShopRite. A lot of can sales tonight.
All right. November 19th, CBS banned a controversial Brooke Shields Calvin Klein ad because, according to CBS, the commercial was too suggestive. The ad featured 15-year-old Brooke Shields saying, "You want to know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing." So that was it.
That would be nothing today.
I know. I don't care now. That would be like, you know, very PC compared to a lot of the shit we see on air. On November 21st, the mystery of who shot JR was solved on Dallas. The revelations that Sue Elling's sister, Kristen Shepherd, played by Mary Crosby, was responsible, drew a record number of viewers. And on
now, what's funny is about that is you mentioned the writer's strike. Now, think about that. November 21st. So not only do we have to wait an entire off season, we had to wait an extra 2 months. Mm-hmm. Because of the writer's strike. So normally back those days, shows just premiered, you know, Labor Day week or whatever. But we had to wait an extra 2.5 months for the Who Shot JR because of the writer's strike. That strike lasted forever, mm-hmm. forever in 1980. And it wrecked a lot of shit.
Yeah.
So think about that.
Mm-hmm. It's still, anytime there's a guild strike, whether it's the actors or writers, It crushes a lot of projects, a lot of careers, even, as we'll see as we go on that this happens more than once, twice, three times, it puts plans in jeopardy too. You know, those slates get backed up and the viewers, the people that pay to see these people is what, the ones that really pay in the end. Also, the last thing we'll talk about TV, December 20th, NBC Sports broadcast the New York Jets 24-17. Shush. 24-17 season-ending victory over the Miami Dolphins without announcers. The only time that has ever been done with an NFL game. Wow. Could you guys imagine watching a football game without announcers?
Yeah, I wish every game I watch with Aikman and Buck, I wish they were announcers.
You know, because Aikman was a plugless color guy, but he played for those fucking scumbags, you know. Maybe Fox should get Phil Sims. I know. Well, it was either that or listening to, who's that fucking jackhole? Brian Gumbel. Fuck wants to listen to him. I'd rather listen to nobody.
Pretty crazy.
It was a meaningless game. It was an experiment because it was one of those late season Saturday games that and both teams were out of it, so they experimented.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up TV, and that's going to wrap up the first part of our show tonight, looking at the year 1980. When we come back, we're going to dive into the news, music, and movies of that year with Scott Criscolo, J.R. Cino D'Amato, and the Doctor, George Ribolino. I am Andy Atherton. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our previous podcasts over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And be sure to join us at our forum at Bigelow34.ProBoards.com for all sorts of wrestling, sports, and pop culture discussion each and every day, where you can make your voice heard. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And welcome back, Police to Be Nation, to the year in pop, 1980. Scott Criscolo, Andy Atherton, The Doctor, and Johnny D. Good first segment. We will be diving into news and music and movies in a moment. But first, plenty of great content on the Police to Be Nation pop feed. Got the Hard Traveling Fanboys, who just celebrated their 200th episode. So congrats to those guys. Mm-hmm. Other great shows, DC For You, Marvel Age, some show where a guy watches comedies and they all giggle. I don't know. What's it called again? I don't know. I'm only kidding. Laughing Theater. Great show, Andy. Mm-hmm. Great show you do. Brother Sister Rewatch Project. Great debate. Should have one coming up the hopper soon, huh?
Yeah, I got one in the works.
There you go. The Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular. This week in the NFL, Cowboy, but now and D'Amato, but Johnny, it's now what? This week in sports, I assume now?
Yes, sir.
There you go. So This Week in Sports, great show that as the NFL season has concluded, those guys shift things up. The NBA Team Podcast with Adam Murray and Andrew Reich, Diamond Conversations, Sunday Groove, a lot of great stuff on the pop feed. And then, of course, You go to the other side, got the wrestling feed, Place to Be Podcast, Main Event, Wrestling War Zone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, and of course all the great recap shows we do, The Doctor and I, with our NWA Power Recap, and all of the great reaction shows to the pay-per-views as well. While you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position, new home for Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Telling Stories, Journey into Infinity, and much more. On our social media pages, the greatest sitcom of all time tournament is in round five. Four matchups per day. All of them mostly fair.
it'll actually be wrapped up by the time this hits, I would think.
Yeah, so the tournament will be over, and then we'll get into the next one. And let's hope that I'll make the big announcement. Well, this will be airing after Main Event, so of course we can announce what it is. It is the greatest, or what is it, the best current sports logo tournament. Did I say it right?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a mouthful. Basically,
I know.
Basically, we're going to take the four major sports in America. We're going to put them into their brackets, and we're just going to do randomized matchups. And people are going to go on there. They're going to vote in each matchup on which logo they like better, and we'll see which is the best sports logo of 2020.
There you go. So that'll be great. And does that mean we're gonna get like Yankee fan groups and?
I'll bring. I actually encourage that.
really?
No, I'm kidding. My goal is a Yankees, Giants, Rangers. I can't bring myself to say Knicks. So I'll just go Lakers. Final four.
And we've officially kicked off.
Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, okay. I was just saying, we're moving on. Well, it'll be a good tournament. We know. The tournament after that's going to be awesome. We've officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project, the greatest WCW match ever. Do your research, promote matches, build your list. The conversation rules can be found at facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. I know we all have our favorites for NWA/WCW match of all time. Unlike my WWE list, which I had my number one locked in the minute I started making it, I'm a little shaky. Right now I got at least four matches in my head that could be that in my opinion could be the greatest NWA/WCW match of all time. The doctor knows those I'm speaking of because I know they're close to his favorites as well. Plenty of time, 10 and a half months to do your research and participate. It's going to be a lot of fun. Of course, check out placemenation.com for all of your great content. Great articles, Trent's SmackDown off Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Ben's Unpopular Opinion, which has gotten a lot of heat this week.
Mm-hmm. God, I love that limey bastard.
Yeah, I love him too. Don't forget about veteran columns like, of course, Glenn Butler's weekly walk around the web. And if you're doing online shopping at Amazon.com, click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use placebnation.com/Amazon, and it takes you right to Amazon and helps out the site with no cost to you. PlaceBeNation.com, your home for everything pop culture. And, of course, our two awesome podcast feeds, PlaceBeNation Wrestling, PlaceBeNation Pop, and, of course, the Jenny Position. Boop. All right. Let us dive in. Let's go to the headlines, the newspaper, back when newspapers were still big.
Yes.
And hop in, Mr. Atherton, for our news of 1980.
And one last thing to talk about with the site, the reveal of last year's stretch project, the greatest televised WWE match, will be hitting the site very soon. And yes. Articles, and it's going to be every match that was nominated. And will get down to the number one match at some point. But hope you all enjoy reading. A lot of hard work is being put into it. And also we have a group of guys watching every match now and rating them. So that look for that monthly also on the site. Yes. So into the news of 1980. January 4th, U.S. President Jimmy Carter proclaimed a grain embargo against the USSR, which is a support of the European Commission, furthering the rift between the United States and the Soviet Union. Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran states that their parliament will decide the fate of the American embassy hostages on February 23rd. Now, I remember this happening, because it kind of scared me, because I was, 7 years old when this happened. On May 18th, the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens volcano in Washington killed 57, It causes $3 billion in damage. That was pretty scary seeing that footage on TV. June 27th, President Carter signed Proclamation 4771 requiring 18 to 25-year-old males to register for a peacetime military draft in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. That's when tension was really high and, you know, people were talking about World War III actually happening. Thankfully, it never did. Also in the news on August 14th, Dorothy Stratton, the 1980 Playboy Playmate of the Year, is murdered by her estranged husband, Paul Leslie Snyder, who subsequently commits suicide. And then the killer clown, John Wayne Gacy Jr., sentenced to death for the murder of 33 boys and young men. Wow. Oof. He is up there, man, with, you know, those killers like, you know, Ted Bundy's and your what the hell's the other guy? The Jeffrey Dahmer's just...
He dressed like a clown. That's even fucking sicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He dressed like a clown. Crazy.
A 6.0 earthquake strikes southern Italy, causing the death of more than 3,000 people. Yasser Arafat is elected president of the Palestinian National Council. And in probably the biggest news of the year, on November 4th of 1980, our 49th president was elected. That is 40. Sorry, it was the 49th quadrennial presidential election.
Right.
The notes messed me up. was the 40th president. Republican nominee Ronald Reagan defeated Democrat and incumbent Jimmy Carter due to the rise of conservatism following Reagan's victory. Some historians consider the election to be the realigning of election that marked the start of the Reagan era. Carter's unpopularity and poor relations with Democratic leaders encouraged a intra-party challenge by Senator Ted Kennedy. Carter defeated Kennedy in the majority of the Democratic primaries, but Kennedy remained in the race until Carter was officially nominated. The Republican primaries were contested between Reagan, who had previously served as governor of California, former Congressman George H.W. Bush, Congressman John B. Anderson, and several other candidates. All of Reagan's opponents had dropped out by the end of the primaries, and at the 1980 Republican National Convention, nominated a ticket of Reagan and Bush. Reagan had his platform. He had campaigned for increased defense spending, implementation of supply-side economic policies, and a balanced budget. His campaign was aided by Democratic dissatisfaction with Carter, the Iran hostages crisis, a worsening economy at home marked by high unemployment and inflation. And Reagan did win by a landslide. He took the majority of the electoral vote and won 50.7% of the popular vote. He received the highest number of electoral votes ever won by a non-incumbent presidential candidate. What else? The Republicans won control of the United States Senate for the first time since 1955. Carter had won 41% of the vote but carried only six states. Anderson won 6.6% and performed best among liberal Republican voters. Reagan, then 69, was the oldest person to be elected to her first term. This record has since been superseded by Donald Trump at the 2016 United States presidential election. And then lastly, in the news, Japan becomes the world's largest auto-producing country. All right, you guys have any thoughts on Reagan becoming president, what the change meant for the nation?
Well, I think it was kind of obvious, similar to 4 years earlier. I mean, I will say this, and we are very bipartisan in on this show. This is not a political show by any stretch, and I've said this multiple times when talking about any of our presidential elections when they've happened. Jimmy Carter was not a bad person. He was a good guy from Georgia who wanted to do the right thing. He was a newcomer to Washington, which in 1976 was welcomed because the country was kind of in the shitter at that time. And no disrespect to Gerald Ford, but he was kind of handed a big fucking mess. And he was just a face of the problems, unfortunately. So he was the scapegoat. And Carter's problem was not his values or his honesty. He just was over his head. He was a great governor of Georgia, but he ran the country like a state. And so he used to bounce cabinet members in and out. And he couldn't wrap his head around a national economy or national energy crisis and things like that. And he just couldn't handle that. It overwhelmed him, I think. And then the hostages happened and Iran pretty much was not going to deal with him. Mm-hmm. And so he was pretty much dead man walking when the 1980 like primaries and stuff happened. And Ted Kennedy didn't help matters because he didn't bow out after clearly going to lose the delegates at the convention. Then A, he didn't shake Carter's hand, and he didn't go on the podium and congratulate him or stand on the stage with him. A typical selfish Kennedy, he just pretty much walked off on his own. Whereas by this time, Reagan, who had almost bumped off Ford in the primary in 76, was pretty much clear-cut favorite for the Republicans. I don't think there was anybody else. And at the time, they wanted a new voice, a new sound, and a new outlook. And that's why he won so comfortably. And fitting, and we'll mention this briefly in our next episode, at his inauguration in January of 81, the minute the inauguration finished and he was officially president, Iran let the hostages go. Mm-hmm. And I remember the announcement. Sam Donaldson yelled it to Reagan as he was walking back into the rotunda or wherever the rotunda, right at that moment. A, because they didn't want to give Carter credit for doing it, and B, because they realized Reagan would play a little harder edge than Carter would. But we'll talk more about Reagan, obviously, throughout his 8 years. But it was pretty much just a change of pace for the country, just like they needed a change of pace in 76. But I've never discounted Carter as a bad guy. I think he just was over his head, and I think the job overwhelmed him to a certain extent.
There you go.
But Ronald Reagan would be the face of the decade. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Bill Clinton would be the face of the following decade. But that, you know, he'd have his bumps in the road like any other two-term president would.
Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Criscolo for 1980 in music.
Thank you, Andy. Great job with the news segment. Well done. 1980 would be a funny year in music because we
mentioned this at the beginning of the show that music would change dramatically in the early part of the 80s. By this point, disco was pretty much dead. Pretty much in 79, it was dead when the guy when that jock in Chicago had people go to blow up disco records at Comiskey. So that was pretty much the end of that. But we would see new wave. Even punk kind of crapped out by 1980. It would be more new wave rock. And you know what would really step to the forefront? We'll talk about it as we look at this list. You know what's stepped to the forefront? Country would become a big pop sensibility genre that we would see for the next maybe three.
Well, Kenny Rogers did that.
Well, Kenny was big as well. Juice New. Well, we'll get to them. But yeah, Kenny was a big one. So the number one song, though, at the end of the year was from a great movie, a movie that Andy will mention in our next segment. Call Me by Blondie, which of course was on the American Gigolo soundtrack. Number two, Another Brick in the Wall.
American Gigolo was the Trent Williams story, right?
Yeah, he didn't want Lauren Hutton in that spot. He wanted Alexa Bliss. Anyway, at number three, Magic by Olivia Newton-John, which of course would come off the Xanadu soundtrack. Awesome soundtrack. God-awful, hideous movie. At number four, Rock With You by Michael Jackson, off the Wall, which is an amazing album, and I think not many people give it enough credit. Number five, Do That To Me One More Time by Captain and Tennille. Of course, Captain would do it a few more times, and then they get divorced. Number six, Crazy Little Thing Called Love by Queen. Number seven, Coming Up by Paul McCartney.
Coming up like a flower.
Great song. Number eight, Funky Town by Lip Sync. Number nine, Still Rock and Roll to Me by That Guy, Motherfucker. Mr. Billy Clay. His first number one, Dr. G. Would you find that funny that after two awesome albums, that would be his first number one song? Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I guess, you know, again, 1980, as we were saying, it's a little weaker of a list. I mean, the 70s was very very competitive. Very good music in the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And number 10, The Rose by Bette Midler. At number 11, we'll go quick. We're not going to go through all 100, obviously. The Pina Colada song, Escape by Rupert Holmes. We're also in a wheelhouse of some great future yacht rock classics, too. Number 12, speaking of new wave, Cars by Gaddy Newman. Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I could lock all my doors. What a great video, by the way.
Looking down at the list, Little Genie by Elton John at 16. I love that song. Ride Like the Wind, Christopher Cross at number 17. Please Don't Go by KC and the Sunshine Band at number 19. Babe by Styx, great album, a great song, at number 20. Shining Star by the Manhattans, I love that fucking song, at number 22. Still by the Commodores, yes, Lionel was still with the band at that point. Steal Away by Robert Dupree at number
Robbie, of course, yeah. A lot of yacht rock classics. Yeah.
Yes, of course, Mr. D'Amato and I know that it's not Robbie Dupree's best song. Damn it, we know what it is.
That's right, it's Girls in Cars.
It's Girls in Cars, baby. Biggest Part of Me by Ambrosia at 27. Oh, This Is It by Kenny Loggins. That's a yacht rock staple at 28. Sailing. That's probably the yacht rock captain song at number 32. God, there's yacht rock stuff all over the place. Here's your song, G. Coward of the County, Kenny Rogers at 34. I look at that. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show, and there it is at number 40. M with Talk About Pop Music. Talk About Pop Music. Yes, great song. Let's see. We Don't Talk Anymore by Cliff Richard. I remember that song in my dad's Bonneville when I was a kid. Let's see. Against the Wind, Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. On the Radio by Donna Summer, also on the list. She's Out of My Life by Michael. Let's see, what else? You May Be Right, Dr. G. It's 75. There you go. Off of Glass Houses. September Morn by Neil at number 9. Neil was getting in his renaissance in the late 70s, early 80s. Off the Wall is on the list. Tusk, from the long-awaited Fleetwood Mac follow-up to Rumors. And number 100, a song, Johnny, that you and I like because we love the album, and we'll talk about the album in a minute, Refugee by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, from one of yours and my favorite albums of all time, Damn the Torpedoes.
Damn the Torpedoes, yes.
Tremendous album. Speaking of albums, here were the top-selling albums in the country in 1980. At number 30, Just One Night by Eric Clapton. At number 29, Go All the Way by the Isley Brothers. At number 28... the soundtrack to a movie that you, Mr. Atherton, will be talking about shortly, The Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm. Of course, because it's John Williams and he's fucking great. So,
number 27, Hotter Than July by Stevie Wonder. Number 26, One Step Closer by the Doobie Brothers. Number 25, Cornerstone by Styx, a tremendous album by Styx. Number 24, The River by Bruce Springsteen. Great album there. Is that the one that's got Hungry Heart on it, right, John? Right, it's Hungry Heart on that album?
Yes, sir.
It is.
That's a double album, a classic. Any Springsteen fan, that'll be in their top two or three, if not their favorite. Mm.
The Whispers at number 23 with their debut album. Number 22, Kenny by Kenny Rogers. Did you have that tape, G? Kenny by Kenny Rogers?
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Number 21, Phoenix by Dan Fogelberg. Who didn't like Dan Fogelberg on the show? Seriously. Number 8, number 20, Women and Children First by Van Halen, which is an unheralded album by them. Number 19, we're going to talk about, since we're talking about this album,
one of the two deaths that occurred in 1980. Number 19 is Back in Black by AC/DC, one of my personal favorite albums ever. And the first album by AC/DC did not have Bon Scott as lead singer. He would pass away earlier in the year, 1980. He fell asleep in the back of his car after drinking and died the same way Jimi Hendrix did 10 years earlier. He choked on his puke. Very sad because Bon Scott had that voice, the ultimate heavy rock singer, no doubt about it. I think of him, Highway to Hell, TNT. It's a Long Way to the Top if you want to rock and roll. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. He died, and of course, Angus and Matt, if you're watching the AC/DC Behind the Music, they were crushed. For you newer fans, it was kind of the way Metallica felt when Cliff Burton died. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't want to go on. But Bon Scott's family gave them the blessing to continue going. Bon Scott would not have wanted you all to quit, keep going, and rock hard and heavy. So they would need to find a front man, and who would they find?
Mr. Brian Johnson. And then they would put together this album, which was the 19th best-selling album of the year, Back in Black. And I'm sorry, I don't think there's a single bad song on that album from the title track. Obviously, You Shook Me All Night Long, Giving the Dog a Bone, Have a Drink on Me. Oh, God. What's the other song? It was a Mania, WrestleMania theme. Why am I blanking? Johnny, help me out. The fuck is that song? Shoot the Thrill. Shoot the Thrill. Shoot the Thrill was on that album. Just an amazing album. One of my, like, 10 favorite albums ever, Back in Black. And that was, and they did that in favor of Bond. The cover had was just black. It was the first black album before Metallica would do it 11 years later. It was the first black. So there you go. And that was at number 19. So Bon Scott, what's your favorite Bon Scott AC/DC song, Johnny?
Oh, no. Shook Me as Brian Johnson.
Yeah. What's your favorite Bon? What's your favorite Bon AC/DC cut?
Probably Highway to Hell.
Yeah, Highway to Hell. I think so too. High Voltage is good. Gee, do you think it was a lateral move? Like, I know you don't know Bon Scott that well. I know you've heard a few of the songs, but isn't it amazing how they got that lucky? Because you don't usually get that lucky after a frontman like that goes, you know.
Yeah, I mean, almost an exact replica in terms of voice. I mean,
Whiskey Gurgler.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to be able to find somebody, and they didn't really miss a beat.
No, they didn't. They would just get better as the decade progressed. At number 18 of the 30 top-selling albums of 1980, On the Radio, Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2 by Donna Summer, who was starting to, not say fade, but her disco run was ending. Now she was trying to transition. Not the last Greatest Hits album, by the way, on the list. Number 17, Gimme the Night by George Benson. Another yacht rock staple, that song. Number 16, Christopher Cross's debut album. That's the, remember it was green and it had like the, what was it, a flamingo on the front or something? Of course, it had two of the big hits we talked about earlier. Number 15, Crimes of Passion by Pat Benatar. Great album there. At number 14, and I know you had this tape, Jay, Kenny Rogers' Greatest Hits, which of course had Lady and Coward of the County and The Gambler.
I had no choice but to listen to that. My dad loved that album. I had to listen to it in the car all the time.
I mean, did anybody have a more luscious beard than the great Kenny Rogers? Absolutely not. Love Kenny. Number 13, Emotional Rescue by the Rolling Stones. Number 12, Mad Love by Linda Ronstadt. Number 11, damn, there it is, Johnny, at number 11, the 11th best-selling album of the year, Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. What an album. Here's your top 10. At number 10, Hold Out by Jackson Browne. Number 9, I talked about it earlier because the song was number 3 for the year. The soundtrack to Xanadu, the movie is hot trash, but the soundtrack is awesome. Number 8, Guilty by Barbara Streisand, produced by Barry Gibb. Number 7, Diana by Diana Ross. Number 6, The Long Run by the Eagles, which will be their last album before they break up. They break up in 1980, so we won't talk about the Eagles for another 14 years. Number 5, Urban Cowboy, that soundtrack. Let Your Love Flow by the Bellamy Brothers and a few other cuts from that album. Number 4, The Game by Queen, another awesome album, which had Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Number 3, Against the Wind, Bob Seger and Silver Bullet Band. Number 2, The Wall by Pink Floyd, of course, the soundtrack to the movie. And the number 1 selling album of 1980, Glass Houses.
Which I wouldn't have guessed, I have to be honest.
I wouldn't have either. I would have thought it was The Wall, to be honest with you.
Me too.
Glass Houses continues the 3-album run of just epic greatness. Not a bad song. Well, if you're a Billy fan, not a bad song on it, obviously. You May Be Right, Don't Ask Me Why. Still Rock and Roll to Me, which would be his first number 1. Great album cuts. Johnny, I'll ask you before I ask him. What's your favorite cut on Glass Houses?
Would be You May Be Right.
Yeah, that's a great song. Now he closes with it. Does he still close? I mean, for the most part, gee, he closes with it now, right? Still in the encores?
Yeah. Yep, he still closes with it.
You know?
He now plays a piano man to end the main show, and then You May Be Right now closes the encore. What's my favorite?
You don't ask me what my favorite is? Jesus.
I was going to do mine first. I thought you had just left.
Excuse me. No, I'm letting you do your thing.
I thought you were like, oh, more fucking Billy. Jesus. You just jump on the bandwagon, don't you? Do you even know a fucking glass house is? No, I'm only kidding.
Andy's an awful Lena guy. Andy's an awful Lena.
It's a good song.
No, actually, I like Sometimes Fancy, but, you know, Don't Ask Me Why is a very underrated Billy Joel song.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Actually,
he does it in concert sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, Sometimes a Fantasy. Great album cuts, though, as you mentioned, All for Lena. Love All for Lena. Sleeping with the Television On, Closer to the Borderline. Unfortunately, it has that god-awful French song, C'est a Twats, which is fucking...
C'est a Twats.
Which is C'est a Twats, which is fucking French. Yeah, G knows I call it that all the time. C'est a Twats. What the fuck is he doing? That's a stupid idea. Matter of fact, if we ever find it, in the studio with Redbeard, which is a great syndicated music show... He did an episode about glass houses, and Billy says in the thing, I don't know what the fuck I was in. I think this is when he was in his fucking sipping heroin phase. What the hell he was doing in 1980? Why the fuck he would sing in French, I just don't understand. But anyway, there was your number one song, your number one album in terms of sales for 1980, Glass Houses by Billy Joel. So there you go.
Oh, Scott, before when you asked me, I got the AC/DC songs confused with Bon Scott and Brian. Of course, my favorite Bon Scott would be Whole Lot of Roses.
That's right, yes.
Named after one of my ex-girlfriends. Yeah.
A quick check of some other albums that were not in the top 30, but we are worth mentioning. Peter Gabriel 3, Permanent Waves by Rush, which has a couple of my favorite songs of all time, Spirit of Radio and Free Will, two great songs. The Pretenders' first album, Sandinista by The Clash, the debut album for a little band out of Ireland by the name of U2, their debut album Boy came out in 1980. Heaven and Hell by Black Sabbath, the first Black Sabbath album with Ronnie James Dio as frontman. The debut album for one, Iron Maiden. So 1980 was a big year for heavy metal. A lot of great albums that came out that year. Gaucho by Steely Dan. Zenyatta Mandata by The Police, which of course had, I think that's the one that had Roseanne. And one of my favorite...
Roxanne. Roseanne. Nobody ever named a song after Roseanne.
No.
Maybe Rosanna, but yeah.
Yes. We would talk about Roseanne in a couple years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, yeah, they did name a song after Roseanne. I think it was called War Pigs or...
And also, speaking of great year for heavy metal, the debut album called Blizzard of Oz, and of course we're talking about the first album of the solo career of one Oswald Oz. What's his name? Oswald Oz.
The fuck?
Oswald Cobblepot.
You should make something.
I don't know. Crazy Train, of course. Mr. Crowley, Suicide Solution. Oh, just tremendous song. Great. What an album. What a tremendous album. The Grammys that year, hosted by Dr. G's favorite guy, Kenny Rogers. Kenny's everywhere. Isn't he awesome? Of course, these were based on the stuff that came out in 79. Record of the Year was What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers. They were going to break up till that song got hot.
What a Fool Believes.
Album of the Year. How about this? Glass Houses was the best-selling album of 1980 and 52nd Street won Album of the Year at the Grammys. Billy, all Billy. Suck it. What a Fool Believes won Song of the Year and Best New Artist. Ricky Lee Jones, complete with her one-hit wonder, Chuck E's In Love. So there were your Grammy winners from the previous year, 1979. We talked about the SNL hosts for this year. The musical guests, Kid Creole and the Coconuts. Not a hot year for artists. A couple of decent ones, but nothing crazy. Kid Creole and the Coconuts, Captain Beefheart. They were still around in 1980. Captain Beefheart, really? And his magic band, Aretha Franklin and Keith Sykes, James Brown and Ellen Shipley, Linda Ronstadt and the cast of the Pirates of Penzance, Jack Bruce and friends, yes, Jack Bruce from Cream,
Cheap Trick and the Stanley Carr Trio, Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, and along with Four King Carrot Soul, Jimmy Cliff, Debbie Harry and Funky 4 Plus 1, Todd Rundgren, and a little-known guy by the name of Prince. The late, great Don Imus' favorite artist, Dubba McClinton.
Yep, my dad's one of my dad's loving favorites, too.
I love Dubba. Giving it up for your loving everyday. And Junior Walker and the All-Stars were the musical guests for the season finale, the one that had no host. So, I got to say, guys, kind of a weak year for SNL.
All around.
Guests, yeah. All right, so we'll wrap it up now with obviously the saddest event to take place in 1980. I remember hearing about this like everyone else did. If you were either listening to PLJ or you were listening to NEW or you were watching the Monday Night Football game between the I think it was the Miami Dolphins and the New England Patriots, Howard Cosell announced that John Lennon had been shot and killed outside his apartment building, the Dakota, in Manhattan on December 8th, 1980. I heard about it watching the football game. And then I turned the radio on, and my brother told me to put on either NEW or PLJ because New York radio will do better than any of Connecticut stations. I think I put on NEW. I forgot who was on. He was outside. He was in the recording studio, and he was finishing up what would end up being Double Fantasy. Earlier in the day, a guy was standing outside the Dakota. Who wanted an album signed, and he would sign it. Then on the way home that night, this guy would be hiding in the shadows. The Dakota had like a tunnel, not a tunnel, but like a rotunda kind of thing where you walked under it, almost like a entranceway. And this guy was hiding in the shadows like a piece of shit coward and shot John Lennon, I think, 6 times. And then just turned himself in or whatever. And that, of course, was Mark David Chapman, who will be in the clink, I think. Didn't he just get released? Or is he still – or is he like on his like 15th parole refusal? Something like that. And he died later that year – later that night at – I think he went to Columbia Presbyterian, I think. This was a devastating loss in music, whether you were a Beatles fan or not, whether John was your favorite or not. This was devastating. Number one, because it was a Beatle. And number two, because John Lennon had kind of been out of the spotlight for a lot of the last half of the decade. He'd wanted to be home with his family. He had just, you know, they had just had a Sean, him and Yoko. John wasn't really talking to anybody. Him and Paul's relationship was somewhat strained. Obviously, that goes back to when they broke up and they had all the business issues and what have you. But he was about to come out of the shadows and start, you know, getting back into the swing of things musically, and of course released Double Fantasy, which would do gangbusters. We'll talk more about Double Fantasy in the next episode. I didn't know much about it. I mean, I was, what, 7? So I didn't know a ton, but I remember my brother putting on, I think, the White Album he had on cassette, and I was listening to them. That's actually my favorite Beatles album, is the White Album. And then I remember watching the news the next day, and people were at were outside Strawberry, you know, outside Central Park, and it was just unbelievable that this had happened. Andy, what are your thoughts on John Lennon's legacy? I know we were all too young to really. I mean, Johnny was a little older than us, but. I mean, we can't really say how we fell because all of us were pretty much kids. But I'll ask you first. I usually don't ask you first. So I'll ask you first. What do you think is the legacy of John Lennon?
Just one of the greatest singer-songwriters of all time. I mean, the guy, his music was all about peace and love. Yoko, say what you will. I mean, what she did. But, I mean, there were so many different stages of his life. You know, he went to, you know, the Beatles, and he went through kind of like, you know, the long hair, the long beard period. You know, he was on his way to, you know, I don't know if it was a comeback or, you know, but there was still, he still had much to give when unfortunately was merged. I was just really looking up while you were talking some of the stats here. You know, I remember hearing this stuff, but it, you know, wasn't on the tip of my tongue. But like Mark David Chapman, you know, he shoots Lennon, then he just calmly sits down and reads Catcher in the Rye until the police show up. That's nuts. And he is eligible. He has his 11th parole hearing this August. So he's been denied parole 10 times already. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't really understand it at the time, like what John Lennon's impact was. You know, it's as you get older and you discover the music, you really, really get to understand like what this man meant to music and the world and generations. I mean, my aunt tells stories, who was born in 1950, she tells stories about how devastating, you know, she's got Beatles stuff everywhere. And it was kind of like, you know, not, I mean, Kurt Cobain and stuff like that wasn't as, you know, he was great, but he wasn't on the John Lennon level, you know, of losing somebody. So, I mean, yeah, it was a tragedy. And, you know, we were robbed of much more genius to come.
I know I've known you a long time. I know Paul's your favorite guy, but what are your thoughts on the legacy of John Lennon?
Well, I mean, like Andy said, one of the greatest singer-songwriters, like you said, whether he's your favorite or not, but, you know, the Beatles were, you know, the number one band, rock band ever. So it obviously affected a lot of people. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, one of those things in history, like in, if you're old enough that you always remember, mm-hmm. You know, you remember that on the news, and that's one of them for me. But as a kid, you don't realize, you know, like Andy says, as you get older and you realize the impact he had in the music industry, was up there with just about any of them, including Paul. So, yeah, I mean, it was a sad day for the music world.
Mm. What about you, Johnny?
Yeah, like you, I was watching Monday Night Football when I first heard about it from Howard Cosell, who he brought, whether you like him or not, he did bring on how dramatic and tragic the moment was. And also you were saying before about Chapman, he's definitely still locked down. He's been denied about 20 times for parole. He's not going to get out. So.
He'll be denied forever. He's never getting out.
But just John Lennon, an icon, and what made it more sad was he was happy at his place in life at this time. Even though, you know, people talk crap whatever about Yoko or whatever, but he truly loved her, and he was satisfied with his life. And you heard it when the Watching the Wheels, which came out after his death, just listen to the lyrics of Watching the Wheels, and it's pretty much just about him. Enjoying life and getting out the game, and it didn't bother him that he wasn't, you know, a big star, and that he was just enjoying a humble life out of the spotlight.
Yeah. What's your favorite, Johnny? I'll go back the other way. What's your favorite John Lennon / Beatles songs? Either John Lennon solo song or Beatles song sung by him.
Well, that's the song. I like Watching the Wheels.
Me too. G?
I guess I kind of like Imagine, I guess. I mean, even though the song, you know. I don't know, just that's the song I remember the most, you know, growing up hearing a lot.
Yeah,
like I said, I was more of a Paul fan, so.
Right, Andy.
Probably go with "Nobody Told Me." Was that the name of the song? Yeah, "Nobody Told Me."
No, what's that song James, called? James, is it "Nobody Told Me"?
Yeah,
James.
Yeah,
James.
No, nobody.
I think
told
it is
me.
"Nobody Told Me." Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I think I'm gonna go with that one. I remember that as seeing the video that they made about that as a kid, and I thought it's a fun song.
My favorite. I think my favorite solo song is Watching the Wheels. My favorite John sung Beatles song is probably Dear Prudence from the White Album. I think that's my favorite John sung Beatles song. I like
I like Dear Prudence, and a song that we all know very well. There were plenty of John tributes throughout the next couple of years. I think my favorite, and I just listened to it in the car, was "Empty Garden" by Elton.
That song is
I know,
amazing.
Gene and I have listened to it in the car. Can't you come out to play? Yeah. Oh, so great. And I walk by the Dakota is a gorgeous apartment building, but you walk by that spot and it just, it makes you cringe a little. And then of course you go to the Strawberry Fields, the Imagine spot in Central Park, and there's like, hippies and homeless people sleeping on it or whatever, playing guitars for money, and or just sitting there talking about music and people lying around. And that's probably like, could you compare it to Elvis? Probably not, because Elvis was kind of out of the spotlight. He kind of killed himself, really, with his crappy taking care of his body. This just kind of came up. This was like a kick in the nuts. I would compare this sports wise with Kobe in that aspect, or even Thurman the year before.
Maybe,
that just came.
Maybe
out
Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly and the Bopper and Richie. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Dwayne Allman. So anyway, that was we definitely needed to dive into that.
Damn Craze fans between that and Selena. Fucking nut bars.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, there's 1980 in music. I look forward to talking more music throughout the decade, because when we get to the next episode, an amazing moment in music / television. Oh, those are two words that go well together. We will discuss in the next episode. But to wrap things up, let me bring it back to my co-host to talk about the big screen.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So your average price of a movie ticket was $2.69. you can't even get a small soda for that these days at a movie. So that year, the 52nd Annual Academy Awards were held. These were from movies released in 1979, hosted by Johnny Carson. Your best picture was Kramer versus Kramer. Best director, Robert Benton for Kramer versus Kramer. Best actor, Dustin Hoffman, Kramer versus Kramer. Best actress, Sally Field for Norma Rae. Best supporting actor, Melvin Douglas for Being There. Best supporting actress, Meryl Streep for Kramer versus Kramer. Best original screenplay, Breaking Away by Steve Tesh, I guess. And then best adapted screenplay, Kramer versus Kramer, Robert Benton. The most nominations were All That Jazz and Kramer versus Kramer, 9. And the most wins was Kramer versus Kramer for 5 awards. That's a pretty damn good batting average, I would say. I mean, you take away, all the awards they went to are like pretty much in the top group. So, Parasite did something similar, which not the forum for it. Don't agree with a lot of that. But anyway, so our top domestic gross in movies of 1980, of course, we'll start at number 10 with The Blues Brothers.
Great movie. Mm-hmm. We're on a mission from God.
You saw The Caddy? Oh, my God. At number 9, The Blue Lagoon. Coming of age story. At number
Speaking
8.
Cans. Mm-hmm. Shields cans.
Mm-hmm. Number 8, Smokey and the Bandit 2. That's where, not beer this time, but they have to get Charlotte, the elephant, over to her destination. And with the great Dom DeLuise as the Italian doctor, you don't want to get the swamp of the fever.
You know what the destination was, which is kind of funny for 1980? You know where they were sending Charlotte was going to? The Republican National Convention.
That's right.
Isn't that funny?
No, she can't go. She can't see. Ooh! I love that. Anytime you get Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds together, it's just magic. Number 7, The Coal Miner's Daughter. Mm-hmm. Number 6, Private Benjamin, which has a great death scene.
Yes.
Who were his last words? Number 5, Any Which Way You Can, with Clyde. Right turn, Clyde.
Equal.
Yep. Number 4, one of the greatest, we would say, what would you call it? Not parody, but a...
Satire,
yeah. Airplane.
Satire.
Oh, God. So good.
What kind of a plane is it? Oh, it's a big, pretty white plane with red letters. Looks like a giant Tylenol.
A hospital? What is it? It's a big thing with patients, but that's not important right now.
What can you make of this? Good. Or make a hat, or a brooch, or a pterodactyl.
Or pterodactyl.
Love Johnny.
And many people don't realize that was actually Leslie Nielsen's first comedy role. Mm-hmm. Like they, people think that Leslie Nielsen's done comedy his whole life. He didn't. That was his first comedy role.
Nah, he was a heavy usually played before that.
Yep.
The clouds are getting thicker and Leon's getting larger.
Getting larger.
What's your vector?
Stucker. You gotta love Johnny.
What's your vector, Victor?
Oh, God. And don't forget Kareem was in it.
Tell your old man to. Yes, it was. Tell your old man to drag Lawton and Lanier up and down court for 48 minutes. My dad says you don't try, except during the playoffs.
That's so great.
Excuse me, stewardess. I speak jive. They have Jude Cleaver.
Chop don't want no help. Chop don't get no help.
At number three, Stir Crazy. One of the great Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder.
That's right. We bad.
We bad.
Number two, 9 to 5.
Ah, tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda.
Dabney Coleman played an early version of Harvey Weinstein.
Pretty much.
Friggin' creepy. He would call like Dolly Parton as a secretary into the office and say, "Excuse me, I dropped my pen," and he'd make it like bend over so he could look at her cans and lecherous boss.
So great.
Before the Me Too movement, I had to fuck shit up.
Doralee, could you come in here, please? Well, what was the line? You're a hypocritical. I'm gonna mess it up. You're a hypocritical whatever bigot, something like that, and they actually fool everybody into
thinking something hypocritical.
Yeah, something like that. Great movie, girl power, blah 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 blah. And then at number one, The Empire Strikes Back.
Otherwise known as the New York Yankees.
Many people to believe opinion the greatest of all these Star Wars movies, because you know, like I said, we've talked about Star Wars a month here a lot at Place to Be Nation, but you know, this kind of runs the gamut, ends on a cliffhanger. Biggest revelation of the whole franchise happens in this. Some great lines, some of the best lines in the whole thing. So Johnny, you didn't really get a chance to talk about Star Wars that much this month. What were your feelings on Empire? Where does that rank for you?
I wasn't a fan of the cliffhanger ending. the big tease that you had to wait for. When did Jedi come out?
Yeah,
83.
83. Giant don't like them teases. What about you, Doc?
What's that?
What are your feelings on Empire in terms of the Star Wars franchise?
I liked Return of the Jedi better, obviously, the first one. So it was probably my third favorite of the.
Wow. Cool. Yeah. I like a different opinion. There you go.
Yeah. Differing opinions is great.
Yes.
And then there's a few other movies we want to talk about that we can't overlook here. American Gigolo, as we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Atlantic City, kind of an odd movie.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
It is. It's good, though. Burt Lancaster, Susan Sarandon, you know, cleaning her tits in the mirror.
I know.
It's pretty good.
I had to work on that for one of the networks I worked for. I had the format. It was very weird. Bronco Billy, that was one of the... Sandra Locke.
great year for comedies. Out of the 10, seven were comedies. Great year for comedies. Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the movie that you and I, Scott, we talked about on the first episode of Laughing Theater.
Mm-hmm.
The great Caddyshack.
The best comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The best comedy. Mm-hmm. Don't say so short, Judge. All right, stop. I can't do it. Otherwise, I'll just be here. We'll be here for another hour if I do it. Continue before you make me start doing lyric. The thing's good.
All right. Dress to Kill that year.
Angie Dickinson's Cans. It was a good year for Cans.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to see Lacey Underalls in the one before.
In Caddyshack, yes, you did.
The Elephant Man.
Good movie.
One of the great. Go ahead.
Did he show his cans in that?
Great movie, John Hurt.
Flash Gordon, the cult classic, with the looked like a long Queen video, basically.
Yep, but Sam Jones, great movie.
It was brought back in Ted.
Yeah. By the way, I have it on Blu-ray. It's right here, Studio B.
Look on the tower. Look at I'm looking on my shelf right now.
Look at my shelf right now. Ted 2, and Flash Gordon, all in one set. How about that?
Look at that.
Flash!
Behold, it's a miracle!
Oh, so great. So great.
Then we got a couple of movies that I bet these are on your shelf as well. The Fog and Friday the 13th.
Correct. The Fog is in my John Carpenter Steelbook section. And Friday the 13th, I have the entire set on Blu-ray. But yeah, two epic horror movies. Mm-hmm. Both quite awesome.
Mm-hmm. Heaven's Gate. The Jazz Singer.
Ah, that's a Dr. G special right there.
Neil Diamond.
There you go.
My dad loved that movie.
Didn't we all want a shirt with frilly tassels on it? Come on. He's the only guy I never know that made Jewish cantering cool.
great soundtrack.
Oh, it's a fantastic soundtrack. It was a great year for soundtracks too. Mm-hmm. Great year for soundtracks. Maybe even the movies weren't all good, but the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Ordinary People also came out that year. That was with Timothy Hutton. And
Judd Hirsch. Yeah,
Judd Hirsch, Mary Tyler Moore.
I think it's going to win a lot of awards in the next Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar rack.
Woods. Then we got one of Robin Williams' first movies, Popeye, which I actually love that movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with Popeye.
It was a little disappointing.
I mean, he fights an octopus or a giant squid. Yeah. I mean,
Commodore.
Olive oil, sweet pea, what are you making, a salad? Prom Night, speaking of, steel books that Scott owns. Here we go. Raging Bull.
Yes.
That's
tremendous. That's right up this panel's alley right here. The Shining.
If you left the jewels in it, it would have been worth more.
Love The Shining. Mm-hmm. Love The Shining.
Superman mm-hmm. 2.
Oh, fantastic. The Planet Houston. Kneel before Zod. Terrence Stamp. Awesome.
Son of Jor-El. Urban Cowboy.
Travolta.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Used Cars with Kurt Russell.
Saw that in the movie theater.
Here's a movie I remember seeing this in the movie theater. Holy Moses. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that movie.
No.
Dudley Moore, I believe.
Yeah. It was a...
that's right. Yeah. I do remember that now.
It wasn't as good.
Yeah, he plays Moses. It's kind of funny. I mean, Richard Pryor's in it playing the Pharaoh of Egypt. John Ritter shows up as the devil. After his, I don't know if it was Lorraine Newman that plays his wife. He tells her not to turn around to Sodom and Gomorrah. She turns to stone, and then John Ritter comes back and he's like, sits down, has a conversation with Moses. He's like, you like trees? You like trees? Yeah. Trees are great. You know, the four seasons, I was responsible for three of them. I mean, just picture John Ritter-ness just having a conversation with Dudley Moore as Moses. Hysterical.
Yeah. I like the Used Cars better. Kurt Russell.
That was Kurt Russell's transition over from, being like kind of like a Disney.
The Disney kid.
Disney kid. Yeah, adult stuff, mm-hmm. yeah.
And then finally, talk about Xanadu. Now, I was handed notes prior before recording, so I am under requirement to speak on some of them.
Yes.
Once Ellen found out we were doing 1980, she's like, you going to talk about Xanadu? I'm like, I don't know. But apparently... part of the, it did not have the box office sex. It was supposed to be the follow-up to Grease for Olivia Newton-John.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted Travolta to be in it, but he decided to make Urban Cowboy. And David Naughton, actually, he turned it down to make Midnight Madness. Screen legend Gene Kelly agreed to co-star. You know why? Only because it was filmed only a few minutes away from his house. Two things occurred during the filming. One, Olivia Newton-John fell and broke her coccyx. During a roller skating scene, had to sit on a special pillow for her shoot, and she also met extra Matt
Latanzi,
who she married.
Paisan. So, yeah.
It featured music by the band ELO. Tremendous hit. Oh, yeah. We talked about Magic, went to number one. You know, it was a financial and critical flop, horribly over budget. Partly due to the $1 million cost of building the roller rink for the final scene. It was panned by critics. One reviewer famously referred to it as Xanadont. The movie was so bad that it inspired the Razzie Awards. It did redeem itself with a parody that ran on Broadway from 2007 to 2008, starring Cheyenne Jackson and Whoopi Goldberg. Also, in recent years, it gained a huge cult following. That's Xanadu. Thank you, Ellen, for contributing. And that's going to wrap up the year 1980 in music.
It was both.
Yes. Off to a great start with this decade. I'm really, really excited for what we have coming up in the next few years, you know, in terms of everything, music, movies, sports. You know, this is, you know, like I said earlier, our memories are now getting more and more vivid. It's, you know, the hamsters are running on the wheels that we're starting to recount a little bit more, and we can, you know, speak a little more firsthandly now about the subjects we're talking about. So let's kind of go around and see what we all got coming up. Johnny, what do you got coming up in terms of podcasts and stuff?
Actually, a busy month of February. On the sister network, there's a Freak Out Drive-In, probably dropping about this time. With the lovely Miss Jennifer, we're going to be watching Carrie. And Extreme Three-Way Dance will be dropping. ECW will be covering November to Remember. And also This Week in Sports. So a busy February for your boy.
Awesome. Dr. Jesus, what do you got coming up?
Well, on Saturday morning, you could listen to the NWA Power Recap. So that's what I'll be doing every week, and maybe I'll get a little guest spot on the main event soon. I really enjoy the NWA recap. So if you get a chance, take a listen, because it's the best wrestling show on TV right now.
All right, check it out over on the Wrestling Feed. Scott, now you got a multitude of projects, of course, three feeds. So what do you got coming up?
I'm gonna do what my PIC does when these shows go late. I got a lot of stuff. Listen to him.
Check him out. Well,
what he does.
So let's see. I got dropping very soon. Probably up by the time you hear this. Latest episodes of Looking Forward, Looking Back. We look back at the fall and winter movie season. We kind of put a bow on that. New episodes of Laughing Theater. The Godfather, Nate Bilton's dropped by. And we watched Black Dynamite. A lot of fun. Anytime you get to do anything with Nate. It truly is a treat. What else we got coming up? Over on the Wrestling Feed, I am joining the ranks of having a show over there. And Scott, you're going to be on my first episode. That's the title. The title of the show is called The Evolution Of. And each episode, we're going to take a look at a wrestler, one who's had a fairly lengthy career, and kind of go through all the characters, incarnations, in terms of, signature matches, the theme music, the gear, best feuds. And of course, since Scott's going to be on, I'll give you one guess on what the subject will be. It's the game, Triple H. So we're going to look.
Oh, boy.
We're starting at Terror Rising, and we're going all the way up to the COO of NXT.
COO.
You don't have to worry. You won't get laryngitis, Andy, in that episode, because Scott may get it, but.
We're going to have to start recording at noon.
So look for that coming on the Wrestling Feed. Also, check me out on Body Pressure Luck. That is JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan are the hosts. I am the third man in the booth. And we got a great matchup coming, so I'm very interested to see how that turns out.
Me too.
So, for Scott Criscolo, J.R. Sinodamato, and the Dr. George Rivellino, I am Andy Athen. Thank you for joining us here on the latest episode of Year in Pop, and we'll see you in 1981. Take care, everybody.
God.